Greetings. From Stonehenge and Silbury Hill to the headwaters of the Nile, to the Great Pyramid at Giza, and the Greater One at Bosnia. All right, to the Nine in Illinois. More on that later. To the obelisk in D.C., to the melted fuel pools at Fukushima. Yes, yes, we welcome you. This is Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells program. Delighted to be with you. From the left seat of the Ark Midnight, hovering on the cyber wave over the epicenter of the world, Dallas, Texas. And do we have a program for you? We're going to speak with a little while, a sort of a combination of thoughts there, with the one and only Peter Schiff, and then Simon Parks. Yes, rejoicing is in order, because Simon Parks, this man is something else, and you are going to very much enjoy, I believe, what he has to say. You know, I think it's time for a little listener appreciation. By the way, we have a crew in Connecticut right now covering the second half of the Freedom of Information Act committee hearing in Hartford over this whole Sandy Hook nonsense. Sorry, I missed the cough switch. According to our contact there, first encounter with the authorities did not go well. Ordered off the property, followed by a presentation by six state troopers. We shall see how this unfolds. They're not at all happy with Wolfgang Halbig. They are not at all happy with our support of him. And I want to tell you something. It's getting deeper and deeper all the time, folks. It's just, it's absolutely stupid. Look, this is me talking to you. One-on-one. We've gotten to know each other now for some time. I do my very best to shoot straight with you all the time. But there is a lot of really stupid stuff going on. You're going, John, I know this. Like, yeah, well, like this, FBI behind mysterious surveillance aircraft over cities, planes carrying video cell phone snooping technology, hidden behind fictitious government front companies. Really? You're going to get an explanation as to why this is happening. This is going to be an enriching experience for you, this episode of Caravan to Midnight. Now, this is from Wolfgang Halbig, and this is what he writes. I didn't write it. I'm just reading it. I'm tossing it over to you, and do with it what you will. Folks, this is Wolfgang W. Halbig, John B. Wells, and I need your help right now. Caravan to Midnight is currently in production of a Sandy Hook Justice documentary. It is the bottom of the ninth inning in the Sandy Hook investigation. It is now time for the truth movement to stand up at the plate and hit a home run for American truth and justice. Please assist me as the final hour is at hand. Sandy Hook is now a very tangible fight that we can together touch and win. It is a fight between good versus evil. We were told from the beginning that we never had a chance to win. Well, my attorney, Kay Wilson, and I are taking on the world of darkness and corruption, literally. These are Wolfgang's words. God is on our side. And we are doing and accomplishing the impossible right now with limited media exposure and hardly any monetary support from the truth movement. Victory is now in sight and failure is not an option in my heart nor in my mind. I'm trying to raise $35,000 in the next few days to simply help cover my expenses and pay my wonderful attorney Kay Wilson for our June 3rd Freedom of Information Act hearing in Hartford, Connecticut. We have the bad guys on the rope. Again, John B. Wells and I need your help right now. We can hire a second and third attorney. That is why I'm reaching out to you loyal caravanners for your support. There must be a financial angel amongst you that will join John B. and myself in fighting the good fight. For those who have already helped, you will not be forgotten. God willing, I intend to pay anyone and everyone back. Please go to www.sandyhookjustice.com and donate now at the bottom of the page, Or you can donate by mail at the mailing address below. Let's fight and win this battle to restore ethics and democracy to our United States of America. If you would like to speak to me directly, you can by either snail mail, email, or telephone. Thank you for your prayers and thank you for your support. Sincerely, Wolfgang W. Halbig, Sandy Hook Justice. I've got his address and his email right here and his telephone number. Shall I give it to him? Here it comes. Telephone, area 352-729-2559. I've called it a couple of times myself. 99.99% of the time I get Wolf. The other point, 0.01, it went to the fax machine. And that's what it does unless he picks up quickly. The reason he didn't pick up is because he's already in Connecticut. Email at wolfgang.halbig, H-A-L-B-I-G, at comcast.net. And if you need his physical mailing address, just send an email to John B. at caravantomidnight.com. I'll send it back to you rather than just blow this out all over the place because, as you know, this is we offer a condensed version and a delayed version of the program just to give people an idea of what they're getting. We don't sell any advertising on it. We don't make any money on it whatsoever. It is strictly to just get the word out that we're here. And we don't have the support of some big-time mainstream media corporation. And I'm grateful for that every day. All right, now, this is one of the nicest things. This is absolutely amazing. Yes, one is this wonderful origami from Japan. Look, it's a little swan, a little firebird, something. But this is something else. So in came the mail, and it was sent in care of the Blonde Savant. And it says, Loco, 808 Loco. But the rest of it says, Benchmade, Knife Company. There it is. You see this? So, the Savant said, here, this is for you. What is this? She said, Tom sent this to you. Don't use his last name. I said, okay. Tom sent this to me? She goes, yes, open it. Apparently he knows the Benchmade people. And the story is that he called her and asked if it would be all right to use our Caravan to Midnight logo, one time only, for something that he wanted to have made. And she said, that'll be fine. Well, here it is. This is a Benchmade Loco. You know, you can flick it out with your thumb, thusly, or you can just flick it. You know, do that whole, oh. And no kidding, on one side it says, Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells program, right there. And on the other side it says, Commander John B. Wells. That is about the nicest thing. I've never seen anything like it in my life. Never, ever thought that anyone would do something like this. Tom, thank you very, very much. Now, you know, I've got to send you a penny. It's an old, I suppose it's a superstition. But let's let the superstition part go. It's a tradition that when someone gives you a knife, you must give them a penny for it. Because this precludes the possibility of any kind of conflict between us in the future. So I'll be sending you a bright, shiny new one. And thank you very, very much. It's just extraordinary. I'm telling you, you people are just something else. You really are. Now, so you didn't like the idea that maybe the Lord Jesus was from Mars. Do you want to know something? I'm going to admit something to you. I think that hearing that was so completely alien to my entire being that it just went vroom. And so when we were assembling the program, I was like, okay, I think my internal editor went, it's okay, go ahead. Just let it roll. It's fine. You know, you wanted to, you know, every once in a while we get an email from people saying, yeah, we really would like to see, you know, we'd like to see something different. We want to hear a really different point of view. Well, you got it from Rob Potter yesterday. And, yeah, I'm just going to leave it there. What else was it? Lord Jesus was from Mars. What was the other one? I mean, he's a happy guy. He's got a glowing personality. And he loves what he does and so forth. I can't comment any further. We bring people on the program and they can say what they wish. And they do. So, there it is. There's no trust whatsoever in Hillary Clinton. She's kind of doing this. Did you see Caitlyn? This is just outrageous. Here we have Bruce Jenner looking like a saucy Welsh lass or an Irish lass. Red hair. Got breasts. Used to be a big-time athlete. Right there on the cover of Vanity Fair. Call me Caitlin. Oh, man. I'm just wondering. I'm just, you know, and then man-spreading. When did sitting comfortably become criminal? He's got these guys sitting around man-spreading. You know, men sit with their legs apart sometimes. It's like, yeah, they do. But unfortunately, that's causing problems on a certain transit system because they're taking up too much room. So the headline suggested that there might be something weird going on there, but it's not. It's just people sitting in a somewhat sloppy manner, taking up too much space on the public transportation benches. Local TV station refuses to run gay marriage ads, but this is my favorite. From thetelegraph.co.uk, aggressive walking fish is heading south toward Australia, scientists warn. The climbing perch, which can live without water for 6 days, has spread across Indonesia and Papua New Guinea and is believed to be advancing toward Australia. A walking fish that can move across dry land is threatening to make its way to Australia, could pose a threat to local birds and marine life. Scientists have warned the climbing perch, an invasive and exceedingly aggressive freshwater species which drags itself between water holes, can survive for up to 6 days without water, has already made its way to islands off Australia. Scientists monitoring the fish's progress now believe it can survive in salt water, and is set to head for the Australian mainland, possibly by catching a ride in a fishing boat or hijacking a car. The fish was discovered on two small Australian islands in late 05, about 3 to 4 miles south of Papua New Guinea. Quote, I think the chances of it getting to Australia by swimming are quite low, Dr. Nathan Waltham from James Cook University says. There is more chance it will arrive at the bottom of a fishing boat or as a discarded live bait fish. It's able to destroy larger creatures by swelling up after being swallowed to block the predator's throat, thereby choking adversaries or forcing them to starve. The climbing perch, Anabas testudinus, has tended to overpower native species in new environments, can hibernate in the mud or dry creek beds for up to 6 months. And it does seem to be able to handle a little bit of salt.
I was attacked by a gang of walking fish. I'm sorry.
All right, let's talk to Peter Schiff right now, get his take on what the heck is going on with this economy. Is it going to crash in our faces? And then we'll give the bulk of the program over to Simon Parks, that's Parks with an E. Check out his website, simonparks.org, and stand by. Full service NASD registered broker dealer specializing in foreign securities, recognized expert in the foreign securities market, as well as the currency and gold markets. He delivers lectures at major economic and investment conferences, often quoted in print media, including the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Barron's, Business Week, Time, Fortune. Broadcast credits include regular guest appearances on CNBC, Fox Business, CNN, MSNBC and Fox News Channel, as well as hosting a weekly radio show. We'll find out in a minute where we can hear it. He's also the author of two best-selling books, Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse, and The Little Book of Bull Moves and Bear Markets. Download Euro Pacific's free special report, Peter Schiff's five favorite investment choices for the next 5 years, and watch the latest episode of Schiff's video blog, The Schiff Report. And so, welcome, Peter Schiff. It's good to talk to you. You're a famous guy. I see your name popping up all over the place as one of the leading authorities, and people really like listening to you. So, why don't we begin at the beginning and tell me? I always ask men not unlike yourself, persons not unlike yourself, what got you into all this? Were you a kid and you went, say, economics really interests me, or was it like, hey, I need a job, or was it say something's wrong here and I'd like to get to the bottom of it? I mean, what got you into it?
Well, it probably was my father, Erwin Schiff, who first started talking to me about economics. So I got interested in it early on. But just to update you on some of the things that have happened, you know, my most recent book is called The Real Crash. And that one came out. In fact, the revised edition just came out, I don't know, a year ago or so. That's my most recent book. I don't do that daily radio show anymore. I do a podcast, though, that people can hear or subscribe to. I host it on schiffradio.com. But you can also get the podcast anywhere that they have podcasts, you know, on iTunes or Stitcher or some of these various outlets.
Okay, got you. Well, that's a lot better when you do your own podcast. You're about to give us the secret to the economy, and then you have to take a break or a call. So you're probably well ahead doing the podcast thing. Yeah. You know, Peter, I keep hearing over and over again, you know, the sky is falling, it's bad. But we all know that this has happened many times in history, and you know, this group of people called, well, they call them carpetbaggers. And a lot of people say follow the chaos. And so somebody profits from every economic downturn. So in your estimation, where are we right now? And is the dollar being positioned to die?
Well, I think it's going to collapse. The dollar has risen of late, although it's now declining. But over the last year or two, it has risen based on the false perception of the U.S. economy. People believe that what the Federal Reserve did actually cured the economy of what ailed it. In fact, it's made us sicker than ever. I don't think the Fed's about to raise rates. I think, unfortunately, we're relapsing into recession, and they're going to give us more of that monetary medicine that made us so sick. We're going to get QE4. And I think it's this anticipation of higher rates and this belief that the economy is improving that has been behind the dollar's rally. When people wake up to reality that the economy is in worse shape than ever and the Fed is doing more quantitative easing, I think the bottom is going to drop out of the dollar. And that's when our problems really begin, because that's going to send an already increasing cost of living skyrocketing. The Fed has been in denial about this problem. They pretend that the threat is that prices are falling when, in fact, they're rising for almost everything we consume. And they're about to rise a lot faster. And I think as the Fed continues to deny an obvious inflation problem and refuses to raise rates to both defend the dollar and to put out the inflationary fire that it lit, it will become obvious how paralyzed the Fed is, that we are just so levered up and so indebted that the Fed cannot afford to raise interest rates without ushering in a worse financial crisis than 2008. And so ultimately that's going to bring about a dollar crisis.
So what happens? I mean, do the checks stop coming? Or is it that the checks keep coming? Because that's what happened to me in 2008. Yeah. I mean, the checks stopped coming for about 4 months. They really did.
No, the checks are going to keep coming. Unfortunately, the government doesn't have the integrity to admit that they don't have any money, right, to make good on their commitments. So the Fed is going to create it out of thin air. So the government is going to pay you. It's just that you're not going to be able to buy very much with the money they give you. So what you have to do to prepare yourself in advance is to divest yourself of your U.S. currency and acquire other assets, which is what I'm helping my clients do. And my brokerage firm, Euro Pacific Capital, with Schiff Gold, is so that people can turn their dollars before they collapse, and they can preserve that purchasing power by buying gold or by having a stock portfolio, by buying assets in Switzerland, in Singapore, in New Zealand, buy commercial property there, buy electric utilities, buy telecommunication companies, buy real assets in countries that can give you dividends in currencies that will rise as the dollar just tanks.
No, you're talking about buying stock in these things, not necessarily buying a telecom.
Yeah, buying shares in a telecommunication company, not buying the whole company outright.
Okay, gotcha.
Most of my clients, you know, aren't billionaires,
right.
But they, you know, they do have some money to protect, and so they can buy publicly traded stocks on foreign exchanges.
Greece.
Yes.
How about that? Now I'm starting to hear about they're going to the ATMs, and people aren't happy there at all.
Yeah, well, you know, Greece, America, there's not that much of a difference except the size, right? It's the same problem. Greek politicians promise more than Greek taxpayers can deliver. Same mistakes made in America. The chickens are coming home to roost there. They're not too far behind here. The reason that Greece is in trouble is because the creditors got nervous and sent interest rates higher. Well, America's creditors should be getting nervous. They haven't yet, but when they start to perceive that we're just Greece, you know, without, you know, the feta cheese or the ouzo,
right?
It's the same country. It's the same problem, just on a bigger scale. And when interest rates start to rise in America, the way they rose in Greece, we're broke too. And we have the same choices, either default or inflate. Now, in Greece, they can't inflate because they're stuck in the Eurozone. They can't print their own drachma unless they get out from under the euro. But we don't have that constraint. We can print all the dollars we want. And unfortunately, that's what we're going to do. And that's going to destroy our creditors or anybody who's saving U.S. currency.
Would it, if we just rub the genie out of the lamp and went, look, Germany's had it. They don't want to do it anymore. They've been carrying the whole Eurozone now for how long? They really have. What are the chances that Russia would bail Greece out just to kind of get a wedge in that door and get a little more influence in that sector?
I don't know. I mean, Russia could do something. I mean, certainly Greece is not too far from Russia, not too far from Crimea. I mean, where there's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, they have some, you know, ports, and shipping is a big industry in Greece. So it's possible. It's possible that they can, extend their influence by doing something with Greece. And I'm sure that the Germans are cognizant of Russia's potential to gain a foothold there.
For people who don't understand economics that much, they really don't understand them that well, what should people know is going on when the Fed is loaning money to various banks at 0% interest? Tell people?
Well, this is a very dangerous time. And the Fed is trying to keep the bubbles that it had inflated. Not only inflated, but it's juggling several bubbles simultaneously. It's got to keep all those balls in the air. We've got a housing bubble. We've got a stock market bubble. We've got a bond market bubble. We've got a dollar bubble. We've got an auto bubble. I mean, the government is trying to manipulate because we don't have a real economy. So they're trying to maintain us. It's like a drug addict. And, you know, they're trying to give us every drug under the sun to keep us from sobering up, right, from recognizing how screwed up we are. If they could just keep us high as a kite, we won't realize all the problems that we have. And so, but this is not going to go on. This, I think, is the end game. We're going to overdose on all this stimulus, and all these bubbles are going to come collapsing down simultaneously.
Now, of course, I'm pressing you for a lesson, and I'm thinking in economics 401 rather than 101. But what is the meaning of this statement that I hear over and over again? We're a consumer-based economy. That just right on its face doesn't sound good to me. We're not a production-based economy. We're a consumer-based economy. So if we don't have any money to consume with, well, I guess that's the end of the line.
You can't be a consumer-based economy because nothing can be consumed that isn't produced, right? And so if we're a consumer-based economy, where's the production-based economy that's making all this possible? Well, the answer is, well, China. Other countries produce, and they let us consume what they produce, but they're not going to let us do that forever. They think that we're going to pay them. Well, the joke is on them, right? Because we can't pay. But eventually, they're going to figure that out, and they're going to stop exporting to us. And then the consumer economy implodes. Because if there's nothing on the shelves to buy, it doesn't matter how much paper money we have. That doesn't mean anything. What matters is, what do we produce? You know, we've tried to put the economic cart before the horse, right? We have to save and invest and produce. And then after we do all those things, we get to consume. Consuming is the reward for production, which comes from savings and investment. We want to skip right to the reward without doing any of the hard work. Well, it doesn't work that way.
Let me ask you something. This may not be your thing, Peter, and if it's not, we'll move on. And I completely respect that if that turns out to be the case. this government seems to be increasingly oppressive, and I'll tell you what I mean. Yeah, not only do we have all this ridiculous surveillance, and not only do we have NBC coming on saying immediately that, oh, we got a whole bunch of fake threats against aircraft just following the non-extension of the NSA spying powers and so forth. And we see this Jade Helm thing rolling out. Everybody knows the military trains where they're going to operate. And I'm thinking to myself, well, so does this mean they want everybody, and some of our guests have said, some of these are military guys, and they say, people are in place now. What does your crystal ball say? I hope you have one that works. Mine doesn't. Not very well. I get a lot of snow on it.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's never really a crystal ball. It's just understanding the basic laws of economics and finance. And when you do that, it's not that difficult to understand what is going to happen and to predict what is going to happen. The problem is so many people don't understand these basic things. They get caught up in the bubbles. And then when they pop, they act as if nobody could have possibly predicted this, when all of these events are extremely predictable if you keep your head on straight. And when it comes to, you know, freedom, yes, I mean, unfortunately, our freedoms are under attack all the time. If we were free, we wouldn't be in so much trouble. It's because we don't have free markets, we don't have capitalism, that the government has basically replaced all the safeguards, the checks and balances that naturally flow from a free market economy. When you have a command economy like the way we do, where the government is price fixing interest rates and trying to direct investment and savings and consumption the way it wants with the tax code by punishing something and rewarding another activity. We have an economy that's totally screwed up. And in order to do that, of course, the government had to take away a lot of our freedoms, a lot of our liberties.
Yeah, well, I use that term crystal ball just as a metaphor for the ability to predict. So if you were inclined to predict, many people say August, September, it's going to be bad. Is there any way to determine with any reasonable degree of accuracy when we might really see trouble money-wise?
No, I mean, not that I know of. I mean, you know, it's to me, you know, either you can see something too early or too late, right? It's almost impossible to see it just in the nick of time. Most people see things too late. They see it after the fact. I see things too early. But the advantage of being too early is that you can be prepared. So when it happens, you're not blindsided, and now you don't lose a bunch of money and like, oh, well, nobody could have seen this coming, is the way people try to rationalize it, as if, you know, well, we all lost money, so there's nothing I could have done about it. Well, there are people who prepare in advance that can read the writing on the wall and have the courage of their convictions to stand against the crowd. Because whenever you're early, the crowd is going to ridicule you. You know, they're going to be thinking everything is great and you're missing out on the party. Right? But you're going to get the last laugh and end up with all the money if you stick to your principles. And that's what we're doing at, you know, my brokerage firm again at Europe Pacific Capital, helping people understand what is going to happen and prepare for it, and helping people prepare themselves by buying physical precious metals while gold is still about $1,200 an ounce. Don't wait till it's $5,000 or $10,000 to buy your gold. Buy it before the price goes up.
You know, I keep seeing these reports about record tax revenues for the U.S. government, you know, $1 trillion, whatever. And it doesn't seem to help anything, and they never go into, what are you talking about, a quarter? We haven't even gotten through the second quarter yet. So $1.4 trillion for what period? I mean, all this chaff just keeps being, you know, thrown up, and these news outlets don't really tell us anything.
Look, the numbers are horrible. That's the reality. We had a contraction in the first quarter, rather significant contraction, which I think would have been even bigger if the government were more honest about the GDP deflator, where the government said that inflation was negative in the first quarter. And I don't believe that for a minute. I think second quarter could be a negative GDP number, if the government is honest about it. And that means we're in recession. And in fact, we continue to get more and more economic data points that are so awful that the only time we see numbers this bad is during a recession. So to me, we're back in recession. Everybody wants to pretend, right, that the economy is finally, you know, cured when we're the sickest we've ever been. And that should be obvious, but we're living in a state of denial. The question is, when is the federal government, when is Wall Street going to finally come to terms with reality and admit what should have been obvious?
What would happen if we just, I mean, is there any way to just demand that that this Fed and this government come clean with the stuff and enact some measures that will actually work? I mean, what if we all just threaten to just quit paying them until they do? I mean, typically, if you threaten to take somebody's money away, just say, we're not paying you. You start going by the Constitution, you put Glass-Steagall back in place, you stop screwing around, you turn this thing back into a stock market instead of a casino, We'll start paying you again. Otherwise, we won't. And if enough people did that, I got a feeling they might get their attention.
Well, unfortunately, there aren't enough of us who aren't going to do that. So we can scream all we want. You know, we'd kind of be like a King Canuck, you know, trying to get the tide not to come in. So I don't think the government's going to pay attention to anything we say. This crisis is going to happen. The government is not going to change until it has no choice. And as long as the Fed can delay the inevitable, even if it makes the inevitable worse, as long as they can keep printing money and kicking the can down the road and continue to make promises to get reelected, that is exactly what they're going to do. It's not until this whole system comes toppling down and there are bodies lying everywhere because of these financial casualties, and now they run out of excuses because it's obvious that this is a catastrophe. That's the only point that they might think about changing. And let's hope when they make a change under those circumstances that there are enough of us that understand the cause is government. It's central banking and central planning. And what we need is a return to the Constitution and the principles of sound money, limited government, and free market capitalism. That's what was enshrined in our Constitution. That's why this country became so rich and powerful in the first place. That's what gave birth to the wealthiest middle class in the history of man. And it's government that destroyed what freedom created.
You know, you talked about bodies, and you mentioned bodies in the street, and I get it.
I'm talking figuratively, but literally there could be civil unrest.
That's
kind of
what I'm thinking.
We actually could have a very dangerous situation on our hands when all this happens.
Well, you remember some years ago, remember when California's checks bounced? Remember that one?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, what about the indigent und the Kinder, you know, and the poor and the elderly? I mean, what happens when those checks don't come anymore? And that can happen overnight.
We have an entitlement society. We have a bunch of Americans that think somebody else owes them a living. They feel entitled to everything. And when they don't get what they think they're entitled to, they are going to, react to that. They are going to lash out, you know, and it's, you know, we're not the civil society. You go back and look at the pictures of Americans during the Great Depression when things were pretty bad. And of course, that was another man-made disaster. That was the byproduct of Hoover and Roosevelt. Had nothing to do with any failures of capitalism. We did that to ourselves. Yet Americans in those circumstances were very civil with one another. You know, there wasn't a bunch of crime and a bunch of looting. But we are not the society that we were back then. I mean, you know, this, nobody was on food stamps or welfare or Social Security during the Depression. Those programs didn't exist. Americans were self-reliant. They didn't expect the government to take care of them. They knew that they needed to take care of themselves. We don't have that culture of self-reliance anymore.
This is such a complex civilization now.
Well, if you want to call it complex, I have other words for it that aren't as friendly.
That's okay. You can use whatever words you want. This is an open forum here, you know. But what I mean is, I understand. God, gear, guns, grub, guts.
Yeah.
But what? Gold? And if this thing happened, this is one of those things that could happen just exactly like the 29 stock market crash. It could be you wake up in the morning and things have really turned bad. And so,
a stock market crash is not going to be as bad as a dollar crash. You see, when the stock market crashes, if you don't have any money in the stock market, it's like, well, you know, who cares, right? Some rich guy lost money in the stock market. But if the dollar crashes, you know, your paycheck just crashed. You know, I mean, that's what you're getting paid in, right? Your cost of living is going to skyrocket. If you had any insurance, it's not worth anything anymore. Because the insurance policy is in dollars. So if you need to call on it, it isn't going to be there. You know, if you had life insurance, you know, forget about what the death benefit is. It's not going to do anything. If you had an annuity, if you had a fixed pension, you've just been wiped out. You know, if you've got money in bonds, you know, you've just lost it all. You know, so people have so much to lose. in a dollar crash. And unfortunately, that's the most likely crash that we're going to see, because the government is going to keep printing dollars to prevent stocks from crashing, to prevent real estate from crashing, right? From preventing the bond market from crashing. They're going to sacrifice the dollar to bail everything else out. But of course, when they sacrifice the dollar, it doesn't matter if the bond market doesn't crash, because the dollars aren't worth anything anyway. That is the point. The worst case scenario is a dollar crash, but unfortunately, since it's the most politically expedient, that's what we're going to get.
Oh boy. So I don't even know if this kind of information should even be put out, if you were prepared to offer it. But if someone were to ask you, okay, Peter, when you see blank happen, tighten your seatbelt right then, because it's on you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would have the seatbelt on right now, because this thing can come out of left field. But look, if you really start to see it heating up, if you start to see the bond market coming down, the dollar coming down, gold going up in big way, you better act quickly. I mean, obviously you should have already acted, because you want to buy gold before you start to see it going up $100 a day or more, right? Or you want to get out of the dollar before it starts collapsing. When the dollar's collapse is on, you know, the headlines, when you turn on the evening news on ABC or NBC and the first story is the dollar going down, you know, it's already too late to get rid of your dollars. But when you start to see that, I mean, that could be, you know, when, you know, it's about to get real.
Any other currencies to run to between now and the time that you can, that you could get, a little stash of gold when we were talking?
Yeah, well, gold, of course, is the ultimate. It's money. It's not a substitute like currencies are. And of course, legitimate currency is backed by gold, real money. Now we've just got fiat currencies that are backed by nothing. But in the realm of fiat currencies, they're not all created equal. I mean, there are some that probably have a better chance of retaining their value, you know, like the Swiss franc, like the Singapore dollar, like the New Zealand dollar. I mean, we're buying select currencies, but not just currencies. We're buying assets in those countries on behalf of our clients to try to seek out the true safe havens that exist in the world. You know, countries that have more economic freedom, because freedom is where you get prosperity, the absence of government. So I want to find countries that have less regulations, lower taxes, government spends less, they don't have big deficits, they have trade surpluses. I like to see a high savings rate. I like countries where people are not dependent on government for their retirement, but their own thrift and their own savings, where they invest and save for themselves. And there are countries, you know, that are closer to what America used to be than what America is today. And that's where your money should be.
You have not used the S word today. That would be silver.
Well, whenever I talk about gold, it's understood that it's silver and gold. I just try to be brief. But yes, I mean, people buying gold can also buy silver. In fact, from a percentage gain perspective, there's probably more upside in silver. Yeah. So as spectacular as the gold gains may be in percentage terms, the silver gains may be even greater.
Yeah, we got 6 or 7 minutes left here, and I know you've got a busy schedule, and thanks for making the time for us, Peter. We appreciate it. Let me ask you this. I think you already answered this question, but how stable is China? In other words, if the dollar crashes, does that take China with us? And is that likely to result in instant saber rattling?
I don't think so. I think the Chinese have been preparing for years for a dollar crisis. That's why they've been secretly accumulating so much gold. We have no idea how much gold they have, but China's the largest producer of gold, yet they import gold. So who knows what they've been stockpiling. They're preparing for a dollar crisis. I think it will unleash a almost like a renaissance in China, because when the dollar crashes and the Chinese currency skyrockets, which I believe will be the reciprocal of that, all of a sudden the Chinese middle class is going to emerge, because everything that they couldn't afford will suddenly be affordable. And all the things that Americans took for granted will be too expensive for us to consume. And, you know, all those goods that are in Walmart, you go to Walmart now and there's all kinds of stuff on the shelves. When the dollar crashes, those shelves are going to be empty, right? And if there's anything for sale in Walmart, you'll think you're at Neiman Marcus or Saks Fifth Avenue. Meanwhile, a lot of goods that are being produced in China that are being put on ships and sent to California, now those goods are going to show up on Walmarts in China, for the Chinese people to consume and enjoy the fruits of their own labor, because we've been stealing the fruits of their labor because of the overvalued dollar. So they've got everything to gain from a dollar collapse, and America has everything to lose. But individuals need to understand what these stakes are and align yourself with the winners in this huge transformation of purchasing power away from the consumers and debtors in America to the savers and producers in other parts of the world. And you want to own those currencies so you get the same gain in purchasing power that they do, which is possible if you invest the right way.
How do you, or is this what people come to you for? How do you do this? I mean, how do you invest in other currencies? Go down to the bank and trade your dollars for some Swiss francs or euros or something?
Well, you could do that, but that's not as effective way. We set up brokerage accounts for our clients, and we buy them stocks directly in foreign exchanges that trade in those foreign currencies, that we get dividends in those foreign currencies. We do this in a U.S. account so Americans can still invest their money offshore without leaving the country. And now you own these foreign assets and you are the recipient of income streams coming in these other currencies. And as the dollar goes down, the value of your account goes up, right? That is the whole idea. That, and we've been preparing our clients for that for several years. And, you know, the window of opportunity to do that is closing rather quickly. I mean, it hasn't shut yet, but I have no idea how large the window is or how quickly it's going to close. But people need to act expeditiously. Always assume that the crisis is going to hit tomorrow and just be prepared. Because even if it doesn't happen tomorrow, what's the big deal? You own quality companies. The stocks could be going up. The dividend income is coming in. You know, you got to be prepared. Kind of like insurance, you know, you want to sleep soundly, you know, make sure you have fire insurance. At least you know if your house catches fire, assuming everybody gets out, at least, you know, you have the money to rebuild, right? Well, you know, if the dollar catches fire, you know, a lot of people are going to get wiped out. You know, make sure that you're protected against something like that.
So we pick up the phone and we call you, and how much does it take to get in on something like that?
Well, you know, people just want to buy gold and silver. I think maybe it's a $5,000 minimum to buy physical gold.
No, the foreign exchanges.
Yeah, well, my mutual funds are available on most platforms. You only need a $2,500 minimum to invest in my mutual funds, which do exactly what I'm talking about. But you can open up an account with me directly. People that have $50,000 can have a managed account in all of my mutual funds. With $250,000, you can have a separately managed account where I buy you individual foreign stocks. So I can work with people, you know, from $2,500 on up. I have ways of helping protect their wealth by diversifying it internationally.
Well, that sounds pretty darn good. So, okay. So I was, I had a question framed here, which was how stable is China? And I'm thinking that they're pretty darn stable compared to us.
Yeah, look, there are problems in China. You know, they're a growing economic power. Think about how far they've come in the last generation. What I think about is how much further they're going. You know, there were a lot of problems initially in the United States when we were just getting started. Some of the instability there is a result of their currency peg, where they are artificially propping up the dollar. So when they let the dollar collapse and some of these malinvestments get worked out, that'll be a big positive for China. But China is a big long-term story. It is playing out. They are going to dominate the 21st century. Now, maybe we'll be able to catch up if we can reclaim the lost freedoms, right? But that's a big if. I have no idea the direction that this country is going to go in after this crisis. I'm going to hope for the best, but, you know, I better be prepared for the worst. But China could end up dominating the world in the 21st century the way America dominated the world in the 20th century, the way Britain dominated the world in the 19th century. You know, the baton of leadership is constantly moving, right? And so I think it's moved again. And that means that the people who recognize this, who make the right investments, will be rewarded over time for having, you know, read the writing on the wall correctly.
Do we have any gold in Fort Knox, in your opinion?
Or did we better. We better have that gold.
That's a great answer.
Yeah.
Peter Schiff, a real pleasure talking to you. And I know you're a tough guy to get a hold of for an interview like this because you do so many along with your podcast.
Yeah.
Go to schiffradio.com, everybody. S-C-H-I-F-F radio.com. And UFOs. These include mantid or mantis beings, draconis reptilian, feline, small and tall gray creatures, crystalline beings, and other creatures that can't be identified. And we've decided that we're just going to talk about whatever we want, because we have plenty to talk about. A shared experience in some ways. Shared, yet experienced separately. His mother worked for British Security Service, often called MI5, between 65 and 79. However, while she was managed by British intelligence, she was in fact working jointly for the NSA, Her job was to type out documents that related to crashed UFO craft that had come down all over the Earth's surface and had then been retrieved by American Special Forces recovery teams. Simon's grandfather, who was a British diplomat, worked for the foreign arm of British intelligence, known as MI6. But again, in his case, he was closely associated with CIA. During this time, he was awarded the OBE, that's the Order of the British Empire, as well as the Commander of the British Empire, that's CBE. And he turned down a knighthood from the Queen. Oh, I got to get into that with Simon. Why would you turn down a knighthood from the Queen? Simon's grandfather was also a prominent Freemason, was Britain's appointed diplomat to the United Nations in the late 50s and early 60s. Now, here's the good part. Well, that was good, but it gets better. Simon went public with his story in 2010, and since then has toured the UK, speaking at conferences, initially attacked by the establishment media, what a surprise, in a concerted effort to discredit him. However, an event in 2013 was to be the game changer when Simon was invited by the British Ministry of Defense to join a small party being given a tour of a secret space radar base in the UK. This totally confounded the established media and has led to a far more serious appraisal of Simon's story by them. Please welcome to the bridge of the Ark Midnight, first time on Caravan to Midnight, the one and only Mr. Simon Parks. Simon, thanks for making the time for us. Great to have you here.
I'm very pleased to be here. It's wonderful to speak to you and your audience.
You know, Simon, I was at the beginning of the program, I was talking about how everyone plays their part in these grand plays. And sometimes you get the feeling that, just the feeling, not casting aspersions on anyone or their individual experience or their sincerity at all. But sometimes you get the feeling that there are deliberate infusions of what we call woo-woo to just sort of take people off the serious track and get this whole UFO alien ET thing back into the realm of the, yeah, sure, rather than the, this is actually quite serious. But it is quite serious, isn't it?
Yes, it's incredibly serious. I think that there are plenty of paid people who, particularly in writing books, seek to debunk or poke fun at people, the object being there to turn the mass of the public away from accepting anything that is contrary to the established viewpoint. And I think that was the problem, because what you didn't mention in my bio there was that, of course, I have been an elected politician in Britain on two occasions. And the second time I was elected, it was after I'd gone public. So everybody knew who I was. It was out there on the internet, and yet I was still elected. And I think that that was a very big problem for some people in the establishment, because it meant that, certainly in Britain anyway, that people were beginning to accept the fact that there is life outside, and so what? As one person once said to me, well, you haven't committed any crime. And there are plenty of politicians out there who have defrauded the community, have stolen money, etc., etc. And what have I done? I've seen flying saucers. So whatever the establishment felt, it wasn't reflected on the grassroots. It wasn't reflected by the thinking of the people on the ground. And here's where we see the great split between ordinary people and those who are elected at the highest levels to lead them. So my story has been very interesting, not just one as a personal story, but how it reflects the change, in certainly in the Western world, certainly in America, Britain, and Australia and Canada, in the way that people are more accepting of possible alien or non-human intervention.
You know, regrettably, the questions are almost always the same. I think we can all agree that that off-planet persons have paid visits to planet Earth for thousands of years. And there seems to be a similarity both in the primitive drawings, whether they appear on cave walls or in hieroglyphics in Egypt. There's a similarity between those, the design of the craft and even the design of the what would you call them, personages, and even their space suits. But it seems to have really kicked into gear. Of course, communication is so much quicker now, and so far flung. We just communicate with just the click of a mouse. So maybe there was just as much going on back in the old days, the way old days, as there is now. But it seems like with the advent of demonstrable nuclear power, as in atomic bombs and so forth going off, that's what seemed to have attracted their attention as far as the United Kingdom and the United States of America. I mean, would you agree with this? Did they home in on us because of our toying around with this kind of energy?
They've always been an interest in this planet because it's a unique planet almost. It's what they refer to as a water world, and there are very few water worlds out there. But you are right. It wasn't actually the splitting of the atom, but it was the potential to put them onto a missile. When the Americans captured the V-2 rocket from the Third Reich, the Germans, and immediately started to see if they could put it at the White Sands Air Force Base onto a V-2, they had the ability to deliver a very destructive force relatively quickly. And it was this, the combination of the nuclear bomb combined with a delivery system that could hit any part of the planet within a certain period of time. It was these two factors that certain alien organizations took to be quite serious. But not in the way that most researchers understand. Most researchers think that there was a great rush here to prevent it. That's not my take on it necessarily. There certainly was an attempt by one group to prevent it, but the group that was successful was the group that said, we will give you technology to develop what you have. Because when mankind, and I'm using the word obviously in its traditional sense, when mankind split the atom, it showed other off-world entities that the knowledge base on this planet had reached a point where we could begin to develop at a very fast rate. And just before I finish, what I would say is that it is illegal for a technologically advanced race to give gifts of technology to a more primitive race. And although many people will disagree with me, and this is my understanding, this is what the Roswell situation was. Two spacecraft crashed and seeded the planet with advanced technology. Because you can't do what we did 200-300 years ago, where the guy got out of the sailing ship to a primitive South Sea island and said, here's a box of glass beads. I'll give you these worthless glass beads, and in return, just give me half of your village. You can't do that. But what you can do is arrange for technology to be given to a more primitive place and see if they have the ability to back engineer it. And ever since 1947, the American establishment have been back engineering technology as fast as they can. So yes, you're absolutely right. Nuclear power was the signal that mankind had reached a point that he was now ready to accept advanced technology and start to make it work.
What sorts of things have we been working on, other than, you know, anti-gravity propulsion and things like that? What sorts of things do we run into every day that are the result of this back engineering, in your opinion?
Well, we only get in the civil side, in the public side, what they want us to have. That's a fact. Some of those offshoots are really just presents for the corporations. The American administration would not exist now if it weren't for the corporations. So there's a very close deal between Capitol Hill, Pentagon, and the corporations. And take the what in Britain we call the in America you call it the vacuum tube, and in Britain we call it the valve. I believe it was invented in about 1880, and about 1888 it started to be manufactured. So you think about it, valves were used in radio sets. So it went through the First World War and the Second World War, our great big radio sets on the backs of GIs with all these valves in. So with all the technology going on, with all the push to advanced weaponry, they still kept the valve, the vacuum tube. In 1947, there was two alien spacecraft crashed in Roswell. within 6 months of that crash, the transistor is announced. So between 1888 and 1947, the valve seemed to be perfectly right. Everybody used it. And within 6 months of that crash, the transistor came out. Now, the Germans were working on a form of transistor. The Germans were the first to create an air-to-air or an air-to-ground radio-controlled, camera-controlled missile. It was called the Fritz 10 or the Fritz X. And they had started to practice with a form of transistor. But the transistor that Shockley was the guy and the scientist who was given the ability to go ahead with this, he declared to the world was your beginning of your true transistor. And so we have transistors. We have fiber optics. If you're in a spacecraft and you are using traditional systems such as wire to take an electrical impulse from one switch to something else, and you travel at the speed of light, you exceed the speed at which the electrical impulse can pass down the electrical wire. So if you were saying, let's turn left at Venus, well, by the time you've pressed the button, you're a trillion, trillion, trillion miles past Venus. So you can't carry information at less than the speed of light. That's why these spacecraft are all fiber-optic, because the information must travel at the speed of light. And in fact, it's supercomputed, it's super sped, so it will travel faster than the speed of light. So you've got fiber optics, you've got transistors, a whole range of things which have found their way into the civil sector because the corporations can make money out of them.
Do we think that on 12 April 1937, Frank Whittle became the first person to successfully start and run a turbojet engine? So effectively, we went from biplanes to jets in about 15 minutes, it seems. And then Ernst Haeckel was, what, a month after him? Is there anything to suggest that, this was anything beyond just human engineering? I mean, do we think there was some any kind of help at all?
Well, you're talking about the Gloucester Whittle jet aircraft, interestingly enough, the Gloucester Whittle jet aircraft wasn't a design in itself. It was purely and simply built to test the engine. But remember that the combustion engine had been going since the 1890s. So scientists like Whittle and others had been well adversed with the actual idea of an explosion within a protected box, because that's what a combustion engine is. So to move across to that wasn't such a big leap. Also remember the Chinese had been firing rockets for goodness knows how long with gunpowder in them. So the idea of flight has always captured people's imagination. I mean, there are some wonderful, what I think are gliders, that are found in the Egyptian sands 2,000, 3,000 years ago. And if you were looking at how you could flight an aircraft or flight a device, and you already have a motor car or the combustion engine, it's not such a huge leap. So I actually think that in terms of that, you're looking at what I call earth technology. You're looking at materials that are very, very readily available on the earth. You're looking at a technology that's already appeared in other forms. So therefore, for me, the birth of the jet engine was a natural progression. Whereas if you look at the transistor or you look at fiber optics, there was nothing really. I know there'd been some experiments with glass tubes that had been done, but there was no real drive behind that. So I see a great difference between what human ingenuity can produce, and heavens to know, humans are fantastic at creating and can create and have created some wonderful things. But a lot of this very exotic technology has no track record. It's got no history. It just suddenly appears in the record. And I think that's very, very telling.
You know, we spoke with Jim Peniston and John Burroughs.
Oh, yes.
And Nick Pope. I think we had, didn't we have John and, we had John and Jim, Nick and Jim together? No, Nick and John together. That's it. Yeah, and then we spoke with Jim by himself. And, That whole RAF Bentwaters thing.
Yes.
Where were you when that was going on? Where was your mom?
You're talking about 1979, 1980.
Yeah. Christmas time, 1980, I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very interesting because Bentwaters was really the holding ground for the tactical short-range nuclear artillery rounds. And all the peace movement had been told that it was placed somewhere else. And of course, all the demonstrations were going on there, and these lorries were going in with just canvas over them and nothing in them. I had a very long conversation with one of the Ministry of Defence policemen who was actually guarding some of these camps, and it's very interesting. Where was I in 1980? Well, I certainly wasn't anywhere near Bentwaters. My mother was already dead by 1980. She died in 1979, so she would be somewhere else, God knows. My grandfather was still alive, but by that time, of course, he was retired, and he would just pass comments. He didn't get actively involved in anything like that. But he did tell me that in 1980, we were, as a country in America, just one click. That's the terminology he used, one click down from nuclear war with the Soviet Union. So, no, I was, 1980, I would have been, just left college, yeah.
So when did it all really start for you? What was the first thing that led you into the work that you now do?
The work that I do in terms of the work would be when the Rothschilds sent an employee of theirs to me to be made better. That was 2012.
To be made better?
Yes, to be made better, yeah. And that's when I started doing the work that I do. That was 2012. Although at the time I didn't know that this person was sponsored by the Rothschilds. I thought the person had come to me on their own. Had I known that it was the Rothschilds, I would have charged a huge amount of money to make the person better, because the Rothschilds can afford to pay for it. So if you're asking that's 2012. If you're asking when did I understand about the things I understand now, probably I was old enough to grasp it around about the age of 5. So when I was around about the age of 5, I began to really understand who I was, what was going on, and what my place in the world was.
And when you say who you are, what do you mean by that, Simon?
In terms of somebody who experiences these creatures and doesn't freak out, doesn't run around screaming and shouting, takes it in his stride, understands the history behind it, understands why they visit, what they're about, and just can cope with it. And I think before that, I was very upset, up to 3 and 4 years old. I think it was incredibly traumatic. And then at the age of 5, somewhere between the age of 5 and 7, I became much more relaxed with it.
You know, we talked with Paul Hellyer, former Canadian defense minister, last week.
Okay.
And he's all into this UFO thing. He's seen the ET file. In fact, in his book, The Money Mafia, there's a bunch of stuff in there that he has reprinted by permission from another fellow who wrote extensively about alien visitation and their influence on the Earth, and how various treaties have been made, and the Earthlings have broken them all, and so forth. Why are they coming here now? What do they want? I mean, are they, you know, people go round and round about this. It's like, you know, from a biblical standpoint, these could be the fallen angels. This is the beginning of the great deception. They're going to trick us into thinking there's no God, there's no master creator, that they're the master creators. And, you know, this is just big swirl of various types of information without any real intel, as it might be. So it's like, why are they coming here? Are they trying to keep us from damaging other star systems with our, you know, a relentless pursuit of the development of dangerous toys, or what is it?
Well, you've mentioned something there very, very, you know, you obviously are incredibly well read. You know your subject inside out. And you talked about who are our creators or who are our gods. And that's a very important point. Perhaps we can come back to that. My response to you is that for thousands of years, these creatures have been manipulating humanity, not for good purposes. And the planet has for a very long time been in what I perhaps could call a quarantine. That quarantine has very recently been lifted. And that's why we're seeing some very interesting changes. I'm not being pedantic, and I often say to people, yes, which group are you referring to? Because people will say the aliens or this or that. Right. And I say, well, which group are you referring to? I know the group you're referring to, but I'm just making the point that there are many different groups, just as there are Chinese and Japanese and American people on the planet. The controlling group wish to maintain the status quo. because it doesn't matter a jot to them whether we develop a lovely pink iPhone for a lady and lovely pink shoes, or we have the most advanced this and advanced that, as long as the system stays the same, as long as people are kept in slavery and the elite can control the planet, they don't care what happens. So the whole object is to maintain the status quo. Now, there are other groups arriving on the planet who are slightly different to that and wish humanity to develop. And this is where we're seeing the friction that's occurring, particularly between Russia and America, but also between China and India. And you find different elements or different branches of military services making their own agreements. And you talked about contracts. We didn't use the word contract, but agreements. But I would also say that off-world alien have also broken their agreements as well. So both sides are as bad as each other. They all sit around the table, sign these contracts, and then precisely go away and do whatever else they want to do, which is just what the human race does. So it's no different. It's just at a higher level.
Isn't that interesting? And I make biblical references every once in a while, but it's the same thing with Daniel in the lion's den. When the angel shows up, Daniel's like, where you been? He goes, well, there's this big fling going up in the celestial realm. What? Yeah, pretty bad. How bad? Well, we had to call in Michael, the archangel, if that tells you anything. Really? Yes. Get your stuff. Let's go. And we're getting out of here. So it's like, it's almost, it's as though the things that happen down here on Earth are the same, exactly the same things, you know, a little bit more primitive tools, but it's the same stuff going on in the galactic realm, it appears.
Yes.
Do these ETs, do they squabble with each other? I presume they do. It's a presumption, but.
I tell you where there's always has been a big problem between the Draconis reptilian group and the grey race that they manage. Many genuine, true contactees or abductees report that when they're put back, they're put back in the wrong house or in the garden or in the high street, or their clothes are on back to front. Now, no alien race that has the technology to take you and put you back would make such a stupid mistake. And this is where there are agents in the system who are deliberately trying to send messages to people and trying to thwart the system. So all the alien groups have elements to them that are acting against them, some for good, some for bad. It's been going on for a very long time.
Now, I tread lightly here because I don't want any of my questions to be indiscreet or invasive, but I could not help noticing that you, in which paragraph is it? It's the second paragraph. It's written here, Simon's biological mother worked for the British Security Service, often called MI5. Why the word biological?
Because that's the mother that gave birth to me.
Right. Well, that's kind of what I was thinking. It's like your mom's your mom. So I just wondered why that word was there. I thought, well, wait a minute, maybe, I mean, did he have, I was just wondering, did he have a, an extraterrestrial woman that became his other mom, but the lady who worked for MI5?
Of course, that's what the established media wanted to try and make the case out to be, and didn't work. Deliberately misunderstood what I'd said. When I was a very small boy, Americans would refer to as a mantis, and what we say in Britain as a mantid, came to me and said that his mother to me. So this obviously wasn't my mother, but it came to me as that. Now, there's been some interesting research done in America, which shows that children, when capable of talking about interaction with mantis, have reported time and time again that a creature mantis-like has tried to pass itself off either as a sister or an auntie or a grandmother or a mother, because it's known that on this planet children are naturally drawn to their mothers. The mother protects, the mother nurtures, and children don't expect to be hurt by their mother. So it was actually Carla Turner, God bless her, who died, unfortunately, of cancer some years ago, who was very anti-alien, but she did some very, very good research. And she interviewed a number of children who all reported that they'd had an experience with a masculine-type creature who had referred to himself as their mother or their granny or their auntie. And that's exactly what happened. An alien creature came to me and said, "I'm your mother." Now, when I looked at this creature, it didn't look like my mother at all. But it entered my mind, and it changed its appearance to look like my mother. And after about 3 or 4 years of that, I began to accept this creature as a sort of a surrogate mother. So when I'm talking to people and they use the word mother, I have to say, well, do you mean my real mother, my biological mother, or do you mean this creature that tried to pass itself off as my mother?
And when did that start happening?
Very, very early, 1963. So it would have been 3.5 years old.
Oh, man. That put the zap on your head, as we say in the States sometimes.
I think it was incredibly interesting because my very first word I said was interest, apparently, according to my parents, was daddy. And I called my biological mother daddy. Because why would I call her mother? Because I had another mother.
Right.
So I soon learned that that wasn't acceptable, that that didn't go down very well. And so, yes, there's the family were always aware of some very interesting things going on.
And so, I mean, again, exercising due discretion here, was any attempt made to say, well, Simon's disturbed?
No, because my mother worked for the NSA via MI5. My grandfather worked for the CIA via MI6. And when I used to report what I'd seen to her, my biological mother would give me pen and paper. And she used to say, right, draw them and I will take them to my friends. So I would draw the spacecraft I'd seen or draw the experiences and she would take them and show them to her friends. So while my mother didn't encourage me, she certainly didn't try to prevent me, but it was very much, excuse me, I was very much left to my free will, you know, talk to her about it, and she would just sit there quietly and ask for some evidence, drawings. And also, of course, I was very lucky that when what people call a handler, when my mother's handler would turn up with the secret documents to the house, he would talk to me. And I was involved in their discussions. The only time I ever had to leave the room was when my mother signed the Official Secrets Act. There's some archaic British law that says only the individual concerned and the agent can sign the paperwork. But every other time I was in the room while very high-level discussions were taking place. I now realize, of course, that was deliberate. I was meant to hear all that.
I see. Because she signed the Official Secrets Act, I'm sure everybody that joins 5 or 6 has to sign that. I don't suppose she could talk about, reveal any details of these crashes that were happening, according to the wording on your site, all over the world.
She was very loyal to this country, and she was very loyal to the United States of America. And she took a lot of that to her grave with her, and she didn't discuss it with anybody. But what would happen, and I've just perhaps tell your listeners it's something they might be interested in, that this guy would turn up with these documents, always at a weekend, actually, always at a weekend. And the documents were in German. And they were a group of scientists, which I now would know would be part of the Paperclip group, who chose not to go to America, chose not to go to Britain, and were not captured by the Soviet Union, but stayed in what became American or British part of Berlin. But because they were war criminals and would have been tried under the Nuremberg rules, they were managed by MI5, and that's really interesting. So they were not considered German people. So the German state, the Federal Republic of Germany, couldn't take any action against them because they were not Germans. I know they were, but that was the deal that was done.
Sure.
So these documents would arrive. They were all in German. And they would say on the top, you know, secret, top secret And the big one was extremely top secret, and that was always in purple ink. We didn't see many of those. And they would have the ribbon tied around them, and the guy would cut the ribbon, he would sign it, then he would give it to my mother. She had to countersign it, then it became her property. Whatever happened now, it was her responsibility. So her job was to, she was given an audio tape where this guy was a translator. So he would say one sentence in German, one sentence in English. So my mother would then listen to this tape and type out this whole document. And Monday to Friday, I went to school, so I didn't see anything. But Saturday and Sunday, I was at home. My mother worked from home. And at lunchtime, she would just leave the document on the table and go out into the kitchen to have her lunch. So you would have the, on the left-hand side, because she was right-handed, so the documents were always left on the left-hand side. There was the original secret document and the pages that she typed on the right-hand side. So I would spend 30, 35 minutes reading through what she typed. And I did that from about, God, from about 67, 68 to about 1973, 74. The reason I was interested in that was because the guy who managed her, a guy who called himself Paul Dunlop, would talk to me and talk to her. So I was involved in these discussions about aliens, about the murder of John F. Kennedy, just about everything and anything, and I was never excluded. So it was natural that when she went out the room, I'd want to read what she was typing.
What do you make of this fellow Hans Kammler? It seems like, you know, the Germans were working on this Glocke, this bell. And some have suggested that, and then there was an incident in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. And people described it as looking like, looks just like die Glocke. And U.S. Army people came and took it away, just like when it came down. It came down in Germany somewhere, also. And but this was not the one they designed. A bell came down, and a bunch of Army guys drove up and put it on a truck and took it away. And then after that, you know, we see this little kind of not really a Stonehenge looking thing, this ring with those vertical posts around it. Hey, what are we to make of that? And they say that Kammler died in 1945.
Well, Hans Kammler was an SS general, and he was operating separately from the normal routes of command. We don't perhaps want to get into whether Hitler died in 45 or not. My own view is Hitler did not die in 45.
That's our information as well.
My grandfather, when asked at dinners and functions whether Hitler had died, would just raise his hands in the air and say, well, MI5 didn't think he would, or he did. And my mother was absolutely certain that Hitler had not died. One of the deals that potentially could be done, let us just assume for 1 minute that Hitler didn't die in 1945, would be the access to the scientists. What you think you'd like to tell your listeners was that all scientists in Germany had SS guards assigned to them, not to protect them, but to kill them if the enemy, that's our boys and your boys, were to come within 100 yards of them. So the object was to prevent the German scientists falling into the hands of the Americans and the British. Hans Kammler sent a message through to all the SS guards once the deal had been done to remove themselves. And that's why time and time again, the Yanks were driving in at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning into a village. And there's the institute, the scientific base, and the scientists in their white coats just going around doing their experiments, and no SS guards. They'd all been pulled out. This was part of a deal. You talk about the bell. Many people who don't have the full knowledge say, well, the Nazis never had flying technology because they would have won the war with it. And that actually is quite correct. The problem is that they had the flying technology, but they had no means to weaponize them. You cannot put a standard weapon that fires a metal shell out of it because it destabilizes the way that the gravity field activates around the spacecraft. You can only use an energy weapon that's pulsed to act within the different phases of the energy field that is created. And the Germans were working on a weapon, and And 1947, the Americans, I think they put it into an F-86 Sabre. They actually had a weapon which they could use to destabilize the gyros and the controls of another aircraft. And then they used a microwave, because it was the British that actually sold the idea of the microwave to the Americans in 1939. And so you could fry a pilot, or you could fry his controls of his aeroplane. So, but in 1945, the Germans were just on the verge of working with microwaves and couldn't weaponize these craft. So they had these craft that could do all these wonderful things, but they couldn't make them offensive. Now, in terms of the bell or the Glock, this was a device with basically the chair, the pilot's chair, from an alien spacecraft. Alien spacecraft contain chairs, but only one of them is the pilot's chair, and that is a chair very much like the Matrix, where the pilot is connected through its DNA into the chair and into a computer. You are wired in. So the bell, you could describe the bell as a very primitive form of time machine. So I hope that's something useful for your listeners.
That's extremely interesting, and I'm sure quite useful. And so, how much of that stuff flying around up there is ours, and how much you reckon is theirs?
There's an awful lot. If you see, it's a serious question. If you go back to the days of Ronald Reagan, when he was really pushed against the wall with that video from NASA, NASA's own official video, and in the end he had to give in and say, look, it's Star Wars. We are conducting Star Wars in space. And, you know, thank goodness these videos are still out on YouTube and you can see them. And nobody can argue the authenticity because they come from NASA. So many, many, many craft out there are belonging to America, very few to Britain. Britain does have some. Russia has a few. China now has some. But it is the United States of America that has the lion's share of this. And, you know, they're determined to hang on to that. But there's also an awful lot of other non-Earth craft out there. And if I said to you it was a veritable highway, it was a freeway out there, the number of alien craft at any one time around the Earth is phenomenal.
Some say you can see these craft with slightly modified little video cameras there, the ones that have night vision, some kind of infrared, maybe. I don't know. I've never looked at the schematics. I just hear these things. And you can see all sorts of things flying around up there. Do you find that to be true? Have you heard this?
Well, you've already answered your own question, maybe deliberately there. When a spacecraft wishes to be seen, it will come out of the infrared spectrum. Human eyes do not see in the infrared spectrum, so that's how they cloak themselves. And when a genuine people say to me, do you know what? I was out fishing and I saw a UFO. And I say, was there anybody else with you? No. And I say, well, that was just for you. Because it wouldn't come out of its cloaking unless it wished to show itself. And then in discussions you find this person's had previous experiences, etc., etc., and it's just one of many. So if you have the capability to get hold of some infrared night visioning or some form of visioning equipment, you will capture some great stuff. Even if when you look at the sky and you take a picture and you see nothing, when you have those pictures on your computer or you develop them, there will be things there that you swear blind, I never saw that when I took the picture.
You know, every once in a while I'll hear an odd term like, I don't know where I heard this, it just popped into my head one day, and was I was on Coast to Coast AM, and I said something about we're running our electromagnetine, I think I called them electromagnetron engines, and I changed it to electromagnetine engines. As sure as hell, it turns out that there really is an electromagnetine engine. And I made mention of a couple of other things. And I really don't know where some of these terms come from. But one of the recent ones is isoluminescence, which is sort of, I guess it's a cloaking device. It sort of replicates what's around, because someone near and dear to me, we call him Mr. Ghost here, he's in studio with me, said, now get this, Dad. I heard where it was coming from. I heard its power plant, whatever it was. It was a rumble, a very, very, very low-frequency rumble, very audible, more to be felt than to be heard. In fact, my own mother in 70 or 71 came through the door and said, I just saw the damnedest thing, and she never spoke that way, never. I said, what? In the end, it was this, it was an enormous triangle. I said, where was it? I said, going down Interstate 30. What direction? Toward town, toward downtown. I said, toward Carswell Air Force Base. And she said, well, yes, I suppose so. So, anyway, Mr. Ghost said, he didn't play the light exactly right, and all of a sudden it revealed itself just a little bit, and it was just absolutely extraordinary. And then eventually it became invisible again, and the rumbling subsided, and that was that. But it happened twice. So if it happens once, okay. But if it happens twice, oh boy, you know. So I'm just wondering where to take this part of the conversation. And these things that
you're growing on me. I begin to like you very much. It's very important because it was a sign. We're referring to the very large triangle craft, very big craft.
Yes.
This was a warning to certain other countries, look what we've got. This was run by the American military. It wasn't an alien craft. It was gifted to the American or the elite Americans, and they were showing it off to the world governments. This is what we have. Don't you dare mess with us. Do what we want to do on the diplomatic way, and then we won't have to use this against you. So it was deliberately shown as a bargaining chip, as a big card in the hand of the American government. So you're absolutely right. If that's what you're hinting at, you're spot on.
Yeah, I mean, the Brits rolled out this thing. It's a lighter than air, a high altitude, long duration sort of craft. And I thought, okay, if they're allowing the public to see a picture of this, I wonder how long one has been in existence. Probably quite a long time. Would they call it the Antares or something like this? It was some name.
Yes.
Something.
Yes, like it's named after a Celtic god of war.
Ah.
It's an unmanned light aircraft, and it's not just a drone, it's much more than a drone. But interestingly enough, both itself and the American Sentinel, which is the drone the Americans don't like to talk about. They like to talk about the Predator drone, but they don't like to talk about the Sentinel. Both of those are very closely copies of the Roswell space crash. So if you can get a look at them, you'll see that the shape, which you could loosely describe as a boot heel shape, and the angle of the canard wings at the back, look at the degree angle of those, and very closely match them. In actual fact, within 6 months of the Roswell space crash, and I can't remember if it was Northrop. Oh dear me, I can't remember the company, but one company was given the brief to build a jet fighter aircraft as close to the Roswell spacecraft as possible, although it would have to fly with traditional engines. And I can't remember the name of the company now, but it was called the Skyray. And within 6 months, Douglas, before it became McDonnell Douglas, it was just the Douglas Corporation, that's right. And Douglas built the Douglas Skyray, and it was within 3 years of the Roswell crash. And if your listeners can get a look on that, they'll see just how close that is to both the two drone craft we've mentioned and the potential looking craft that crashed in Roswell.
We can't share this picture with you, but I just want to show you this thing.
Sure.
We made a little trip out of town, and I think we should be able to. Can you see this?
Yes, I can.
Do you see the little green dot down at the bottom?
Yes. Yes, I do. It's just slightly out of phase. Yeah.
Well, three different cameras shot by three different people captured this thing coming out of that ring around the sun.
Yeah.
And it wound up down by a tree.
Okay.
And I thought, wow, now that's really odd. And these little orbs, I mean, they're all over the place. There's one on the screen right now. I mean, it seemed to come from a ghost. Where did it come from? The center? Yeah, came up from the center down the side, and then all of a sudden it was in front of this tree, like, I don't know, 15, 20 meters away. Do we have any idea what those are? I mean, if one camera had captured it, it would have been like, yeah, okay, but I see these occasionally in photographs. Sometimes they're around people, and I go, photographic anomaly. But when three different cameras operated by three different people catch it, I'm thinking it must be real.
Okay, the question I would ask is, can you give an idea of size of the orb?
Well, proportionally when we, well, there's another part too that you can't see, and that's this sort of upside down. If you can picture a flying saucer with, you know, you've got the hemisphere on the top and bottom, but just take the top one off. And so you've got sort of a, almost a cereal bowl with the elongated lips or an elongated rim. That's where this thing seemed to come from. And it appeared at the about 7 o'clock, as you're looking at this circle around the sun, that's where the orb came from. And so, looking at it, within the context of our perspective, it must have been quite large. But then, when it came down to where we were, it was rather small. I estimated it to be not even as big as a soccer ball.
Right. There, to my knowledge, there are two types of orbs. The orbs you've related to in photographs, not all of them are camera anomalies. Some are genuine orbs, and these are energy orbs. This is when something can project its consciousness into this dimension. Now, we're in the third dimension. We're in the third dimension. What's up?
I was just struck by something. It's really odd having this. I'm not going to have some sort of a freak out or a breakdown here during the program, but I want to tell you something. And I want to share this with you, and we haven't shared it with anybody outside the crew. But I you can tell within a few minutes whether or not you have a sympathy with someone. And actually, I like you quite a bit too already.
Thank you.
Stepping into the kitchen area of this house out on the West Coast, a very famous city that's known for the ground shaking. And I don't mean L.A. Everybody got it? Right. I was hit with something, and Mr. Ghost was hit with something, that it was almost as though it hit me so hard I was afraid that we had both been poisoned. Although, I mean, it was almost a mortal event.
Okay.
I'm not somebody who's prone to this stuff. I mean, airplanes, motorcycles, I mean, you name it, you know, whatever, you know, like that Who song, what is it, I'll take it, you know, that thing. I'm not easily traumatized. But this was something really odd. This was like something was... Sing out, Ghost. No, he's not going to. Well, how would you describe that? If you've ever had an experience where you feel like, for no reason at all, it's like, I'm going to pass. I feel like I'm going to pass out. It wasn't like that, really. It was more like, I'm looking at a really, really unpleasant reality that is potentially lethal.
Right.
And that was right after that orb was hanging around, and you just said something about projecting consciousness, and I thought it was most assuredly on that level. I'd like to call it second level, as they referred to in, what was it, Zardoz?
Okay.
You remember that one? Yes, and that ring around the sun. I've seen a ring around the moon. Oh, look, it's going to rain. Fine. But a ring around the sun, some people have said, oh, yeah, I see those all the time. Well, I've never seen one at all, and I've been around several decades now. I don't recall ever seeing one. It was just absolutely extraordinary. So I wonder what that was all about. I mean, and that's about as far as I can take it.
Well, it's very, very interesting, and thank you for sharing that. This is the third dimension, and it's a very heavy dimension. If somebody, for argument's sake, was in the fourth dimension and projected their consciousness here, that consciousness would be squeezed into a ball shape. That's why all our planets and stars appear round, because the matter is forced into a circle. That's why the Earth is round. So when somebody projects their consciousness, it is also forced into a circle, and that's why photographs genuinely, on occasion, capture something the size of an orange or the size of a ping pong ball. This is somebody's consciousness being projected into your space, either just to observe you or to attack you or to give you ideas or thoughts. So that's one half. The orb that you appear to have photographed, and I think that's genuine from the picture you've shown me, and thank you for sharing that, is metallic. Now, these metallic orbs can change size. So it could actually have been much larger, and as it approached the Earth, it actually reduced in size, because time and space in other places is not the same as on this Earth. The dimensionality is different. These are metallic orbs, which are samplers. They go around and take samples of the atmosphere, samples of the soil. They are continually monitoring the condition of the life on Earth, and they're also spying and observing. So on one half, on the photographs, you are generally capturing an energy consciousness, and on the other, you're capturing a metal ball. In Britain, we went through a phase for many years of crop circles being made. These were made by these metal ball objects. So that's my take on both of those.
Do you know, I've referred to them over the years as task orbs, because they seem to show up. That's what I call them, task orbs.
That's really good.
And, a couple of them will swarm somebody's Iranian fighter jet, decide to shut off his panel just as he locks on it, and then they go away and the panel comes back up. It's absolutely amazing.
I'll just quickly tell you that, and I always try whenever I get the chance to talk to a fighter pilot, whether they're American or, British, to alert them to the fact that when engaging an alien spacecraft, the moment that they get a radar lock, that is considered an act of war.
I'm sure.
And they don't. But pilots didn't understand that. Pilots only thought that firing the missile at the alien spacecraft was the act of war. But gaining the lock, and I always say to people, if you're in a fighter, and your ground control tells you to lock on, just say you couldn't get a lock. Because otherwise something's going to happen to you.
Well,
so I just wanted to say that, because if there's any United States Air Force pilots listening, please do not gain a lock on an alien spacecraft, because it would be the last thing you do.
That seems like an extraordinarily silly thing to do. Well, you've pointed the gun at them. You've just let them know that you've pointed the gun at them. So, yes, I would completely agree with their attitude that might follow. And may I just go on a... I'll try and be as discreet as I can as I go into my American-style rant for a moment. Some people out there think that they understand everything. I heard someone say, do we remember who said some people don't know anything because they understand everything too soon? And that would be the case in some of these. What's the name of that effect that only occurs in Norway, Ghost?
The Aurora Borealis.
No, not that one. What is it?
The
Hesgal?
Hesla.
Yeah. It appears that we were talking with, can I let this out of the bag? Talking with Chris. Chris Putnam, he and Tom Horn went up to the Lucifer telescope apparatus at Mount Graham, where the deal was funded by the Vatican in cooperation with NASA.
Vatican.
Sorry?
Yes.
Sorry, I stepped all over you, sorry.
The Vatican operate. The Vatican operate two, one's a radio telescope and one's an infrared.
Yeah, I was wondering how that deal got put together, but that's another story, unless you have some light to shed on. But anyway, Ghost sent his, he'd captured it on his smartphone, and it's just the most amazing thing. He put it up on YouTube, and some people are saying, oh, that's just a really bad Photoshop. It's like I'm looking right at the camera now, and I'm telling you, we don't contrive anything. You have only my word for it, but you have it. There's no Photoshopping. There's no honor in it. There's no integrity in it. There's no money in it. There's nothing in it for any of us in this crew to fake anything. Simon, I was wondering, would it be all right if we paused for about 5 minutes? Simon, that was a very interesting analysis of what these orbs are, and the effect that I was experiencing became clear, and so now what I'm doing is like not thinking about it, because I begin to feel a little taste of the same thing as I think about it, and it's just I just wonder what's going on here. If this has been going on for thousands of years down here on this planet, then it's nothing new. But a lot of people get the idea that there's been an increase in this, and that we are perhaps some sort of an event window is opening. Do you get that sense, or do you think it's business as usual between us and the ETs?
Well, on a personal level, first of all, anybody who's alive on this planet now, one of two things. You're either here as a witness, as a member of the audience, or you are an actor. You are taking part in something for good or ill. In your own case, you obviously clearly made a decision for good, and there will be some elements that don't like that and are seeking to either prevent you or to change your aspect or change the way you are. That is, people say that goes with the territory. That's not to excuse it, but unfortunately, when we put ourselves into the forefront, these things can happen. But you know what? You're not dead. I'm not dead. And so therefore there's something looking after us, because otherwise we'd be long dead. So that gives us the strength, I think, to carry on. Before I answer that, I just develop that a little bit more. I did a conference or a symposium last fall. Oh, aren't I good? I'm using American terminology. I should have said last autumn, last fall. And I did my conference and I came out and there was a guy there, a lord, who wanted to speak to me. And he said that he was here on behalf of a group of people and wanted to ask me a question. And he would buy me a free lunch. Well, in Great Britain, we're not as advanced as you guys. And the result is that if anybody buys you anything in this country, you have to be immediately suspicious.
That's the same over here.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not so bad then. He asked me a question, and it took me over 2 days to answer it in 3 segments, because it was, the question wasn't complex, but the answer was. Having answered the question in the first phase, he seemed to be quite happy with that. And he said, I'm here to make you an offer. And I did actually call over an independent witness to sit with me during this conversation, because I wanted somebody to be able to confirm, if necessary, what he'd said. And he said to me that the group of people that he was representing had been watching me very carefully and had told him, as their agent, that everything I'd said was true, and therefore they wanted to offer me the following. And the offering was bodyguards, armoured vehicles, and if the worst came to the worst, an underground bunker beneath Salisbury Plain, where I and my loved ones could go, and there was no charge for any of that. And I asked why. Why would you be very kind and offer this? And they said, because you are worth protecting. Now, there is a war going on this planet, under it, on it, and above it. And if we are taking the role that we take, we do so because we have no choice. We are driven by it. Something inside us means that we have to do this. Because if we don't do this, we are turning our back on our destiny or on what we need to do. And you do your job because you have to. That's why you do it, because you're a good person, and if you didn't do it, nobody else would. So for all the negative stuff that we get, there is a lot of positive stuff that protects us and gives us that push, and you know, that slap on the back to say, well, you did that okay, now you get on to the next task. So it's important that viewers and listeners actually appreciate that, you know, you see these people who write all these books and it seems to be all great and fun. I mean, I've never had a book published. But there's a hell of a lot of hard work that goes on in the background. And it sometimes can be quite tricky. So in terms of the way it's going, this is an event. 2015 is important, but it's not as important as, well, the own Georgia Guidestones are giving 2016. I think it's June or July. But 2017, the back end of that, that's a very crucial point, very crucial date. And I hope that the human race's consciousness is raised at a high enough level come that date, so that, you know, what needs to happen can happen. And I always said to people that 2012 did happen. The 21st of December 2012 was a real event. The problem is that everybody expected the ground to open or a firework display. They wanted something physical, because that's the way it is on this planet. But the changes that are coming are not physical. Well, they are, but that's the last thing that we'll see. These changes are happening on an energy basis, and the physical changes will come after that. So it is difficult for people who have been trained, is the right word, through the education system, trained to only believe what they can see and touch. Unless, of course, it's God. because God is a religion, and therefore you don't have to see God or touch God, but you can believe in God because the system says that's real. Actually, God is real. It's religion that's not so good, in my view. So what I'm saying is that these are very, very important times, and anybody who's alive now on this planet is blessed, because you are in on the closing of one circle and the opening of another. So, yeah, it's an exciting time.
You know, I'd said that many times. Would you look in our genealogical record and see if we're related to anyone named Parks with an E? Because there's a real sympathy here, Simon. I had said and continue to say ad nauseum for some of our beloved caravanners and caravanners yet to be, that who are listening to this condensed and delayed broadcast, just to give you a little taste of what you're missing, that there was so much angst in the world, there was enough angst to cause something to happen, even if really nothing was going to happen, according to the numbers, so to speak. But it turns out that it was a great awakening. I've never seen so much transparency in things that heretofore had been just obscured from view. We just went on believing the existence of a certain paradigm. We come to find out it's a false paradigm. The misery of it is that there's so little pushback against it. And I just wonder if, it's like, well, maybe it's a two-stage awakening. Maybe there's the awareness part and the action comes later, because I really don't see, you know, given the potential for widespread disaster, whether naturally induced or inflicted on humanity by other men, and some of the girls too, I just wonder if now we're still in the awareness phase, and around 2017 will be the actual action part, which is, you know, has the potential to be quite ugly. I hope it isn't, but it may be.
For the last 8 months, unfortunately, on an energy basis, we've been in a stalemate between what you could call the positive side and the negative side. There is actually an absolute balance at the moment. Neither side has got the ascension. And because of that, there is a lot of disquiet. There's a lot of people beginning to feel jumpy, irritable. People who are very spiritual are beginning to wonder what's actually going on and happening. And I suppose this is always going to happen until the energy builds up to such a point that it's pushed over the edge. And I don't mean the edge in a fearful way. What we're waiting for is human consciousness. As long as human consciousness accepts this system and accepts that this is the best way to be, we won't move forward. When enough people say, I'm done with this, I want a new way of everything, a new way of electing my leaders, a new way of buying something from the shop, a new way of dealing with people, a new way to value life. When human consciousness rejects the system that it has been sold, then we will move forward. But it's fear, because people are frightened of letting go of the little they have, because they think that what is around the corner is unknown and is scary. If you think about the original Star Trek, it's to boldly go where, well, won't use the original one because that's very sexist, isn't it? But to boldly go where no one or no person has gone before. That's what humans can't do, really. Really, on a mass level, people are fearful of changing and developing. And that's been used by the elite to play on that fear, to keep people in the corner, keep them boxed up. But it is changing, but it's not changing fast enough.
Isn't it amazing, all the ridiculous things all these images? I mean, it'd be difficult to deny the effect that, you know, all these signs, lights, motion, and automobiles. I was sitting at a restaurant last night just looking out the window, and I saw the speed at which these cars, these big trucks, lorries, are going by, and I just thought, it's all going just a little bit too fast, and therefore just a little bit too far. Just hit with all of this stuff all the time, and then all this rubbish coming over television primarily, and, you know, Ray Davies, I'm quite a fan of his with his song Lola, you know, the girls will be boys and boys will be girls thing. It's like, now we have this this outstanding athlete who's decided to be Caitlin now. He used to be Bruce, now he's Caitlin. And I'm thinking to myself, why is this national news? I mean, what is this? What is the meaning of all of this? This useless distraction. Nobody really cares what anyone else does. It's like, the dimensions of this one's bottom, and this one's decided he's not going to be a man anymore, even though he's a father of children. He's going to be a woman now. And I'm just wondering, why are we being subjected to this? Why doesn't everybody just do the old Magooan thing and just mind your own business? <You know?
laughs> Well, we had Magoo over here, so I know who you mean. The problem is that people have been through the education system and have been given that as a value. In other words, these are the images that you should aspire to. So this sort of voyeurism, I'm going to look in and see what's going on in this particular soap opera, or look in and see what's happening with this model or this pop star or film person. And it is to fill a gap in people's lives. Because the gap has been created, the gap that should be filled with a person being spiritual, being looking to self-develop, to question themselves, how they can best serve others, how they can go through their daily life and be good and kind and honest, not a walkover, not being pushed around, but just be fair and true. But instead of that, these people are chasing the latest technology, looking at certain things made of certain colours, always trying to buy something that they can't afford. And so that's how the system has trapped people. It's not that people are inherently bad. People are not bad. People are good. The problem is people are very naive, and I mean that in a nice way, because most of us wouldn't think that our government would do anything bad to us, because we wouldn't do anything bad to anyone else. So we tend to say, no, they wouldn't do that. No, they couldn't do that, couldn't possibly do that. And time again, the truth comes out, and we read of some absolutely horrific things that have been done, and police have arrested the person, it's gone to court, etc. But still, we hide behind, well, that's just one or two people, and we don't want to move to the next stage, which is the system needs to be changed. We're running out of time. The system does need to be changed, and it needs to be changed pretty quickly. You guys yourself have Jade Helm taking place, and this is very important, because I'm sure for those of you who you know, listening in California or Texas, these are two of the states that the central administration does not want to lose control of. That's why you've had big displays there. It's not to frighten the people. I mean, a lot of people are misunderstanding this completely. Jade Helm is not there to put intimidation into the people. That was not its plan. Jade Helm is there to isolate the troops from the people. It is make the soldiers say they are different from the people. I've talked about this before. There have been two meetings at the National Security Council. This obviously is not public. You're not going to find this on the internet. But there have been two meetings at the National Security Council. The NSA produces the documents, the papers, which go to the council, and then the council debate it, et cetera, et cetera. One of the first ones was, if there was a revolution in America, would we stay in control? And the reply came back, no, we wouldn't. So the best response was, which American states could we hang on to? So the NSA went away and did some number crunching, and they're very good at number crunching in the NSA, and the results came back, and the politicians said, these are the states we want to hang on to. And one of the elements in that was that there are, apparently in the United States of America, there are around 1 million cops, and I think the American population, 230 million, is it that?
330,
sorry, I got the number wrong. 330 million. Right. So when they looked at it, they realized that on a one-to-one basis, there was no way they could control the situation. The difficulty they had was that every girl and boy on the high street, on the block, makes cookies to sell for veterans. The connection between the United States military and its people is very strong. So if the military were ordered to shoot on their population, it wouldn't happen. However, the report actually said that the police would, that the American police are now so separated from their communities that they would shoot. Now, that wasn't any good for the National Security Council, because they have the military. So they want to break the tie between the community and the army. And the way to do that is to dress you all up in your full combat gear and march you through the town so that it's, we are separate from the people. So that was that. Also, this was run through computer war games, and they were working out how quickly they could get numbers and equipment into different places. And gone are the days when soldiers have to lie down, pretend to be dead, and someone goes and counts them. They can all map this out on a computer. And two of the states they did not want to lose were Texas and California. Texas, because I understand the Texans are very strong-willed and independent, don't like to be pushed around. And the Californians, because they're very independent, and they question a lot. So Jade Helm is a process to bring a separation between the people and the military and to war game out. So that's what that is, because they know in the next 2.5 years there could be a situation where they are facing a very difficult time. And I'll just quickly finish off that a number of the false flags that were used about gun law, gun control, again, commentators misunderstood what was going on here. It was never the intention to take away the guns from the American citizens, but it was the intention to take away high-powered rifles and semi-automatic weapons. As a colonel, and I can't say which unit or what have you, but a colonel in the American military said to me, if I am and my men are walking down the street and somebody shoots at me, they have to open a window and stick the gun out to shoot at me. But we don't, because our bullets will go right through the walls of the house and kill them inside. So they didn't want the citizens to have the same high-powered weapons as the military. So you've had a number of false flags specifically to remove high-powered weaponry from the citizens. So these are the things that are discussed at very high level and do not come out in the public. So I just wanted to throw that in because I think people need to know that.
Here we have I don't mind telling anybody this, do I? That we have a crew up in Connecticut right now. Looking after the Wolfgang Halbig, who's investigating this Sandy Hook incident. He's convinced that it's a fraud. And one way or another, we're going to find out. I suspect that that was one of them. The Aurora thing was another, and on and on and on. And then, yeah, you know, I'll tell you, you make... I have to say this, and this is not to the... This is not to denigrate anything that any of our guests have said by way of, I mean, they come on the program, they express their thoughts, but I got to tell you, this one makes absolutely the most sense. It really does. It's never exactly what you think that it might be. It's something a little more subtle. And it's just, this is Americanism for you. Great stuff.
Thank you. You did mention it in the bio when we kicked off, and maybe it would just be helpful to understand why I'm still alive, because that is a very useful question. When I initially went public, and the media uncoordinated attacked and tried to make me out to be a fool, I put up with that for about a year and a half. And then I was invited to, and it is relevant to you because it's an American base on British soil. It is the only three-phased array radar in the world. The Americans have a two-phased array on your own country, but this is the only three-phased array. And it's nominally called a British base, but it is run by the Americans. And I got an invite, would I like a tour of this radar base? And it's a space radar base. And of course I said yes. And people were saying to me, well, why would they invite you? And I said, well, they're probably interested in me. And I had a tour, and I had a 3-hour tour, and at the end of it, I got a nice little, memento of my tour. I was given something which is, I keep very secure. It's a very nice medal sort of thing. But that changed the dynamics because I had media directors phoning me up saying, I don't know what's going on here. I've been told by my boss to basically make a joke out of this. Yet at the highest levels, you have been given 3 hours tour. Yet you've told the world that your mother and grandfather worked for MI5, MI6, the NSA and CIA. You see aliens. You should be the biggest security risk anywhere on the planet. yet you have been given a tour around a radar base. So this was a big change. And then I did a breakfast television interview, which in Britain is the biggest. It's called This Morning. That's the name of it. And it's, for Britain, it's a very, very big deal. And I did a 15-minute interview, and I couldn't have asked for a more reasonable discussion with two people on primetime television who had the greatest opportunity to attack me but didn't. So there have been some huge changes. And then last year, of course, the BBC phoned me at home and said, the Pope, the new Pope, has just announced that he will baptize aliens. And we thought, who do we need to speak to? And your name came up first. So from being the person who was ridiculed and made a fool of, it's now very different. And now the media, the established media, don't quite know what to do.
What you make of this, Pope? Immigration and global warming and baptizing aliens and partnering with NASA for a telescope and calling it Lucifer O. What next?
Well, he, in fairness to him, he did inherit the telescopes.
Okay.
He did inherit them. They were already there. I think he just does what everyone else does when they're Pope. But I think this one's got a bit of a spark of humanity about him. I think the previous Pope, I really wouldn't have invited him round for a cup of English tea. But this Pope, yes, I might just ask him round to have a chat and see what he's about.
Well, I got mad at him the other day, and I'm just like, why don't you just attend to the faithful and just stay out of all this other stuff? You're not helpful. But, I mean, when Raul Castro says, I'm so impressed with this Pope, I think I may go back to church. It's like... Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm. Wouldn't hurt you. Mm. Probably not. Can we, you know, your explanations, you know, the answers to my questions, and then the, just the things that you've said that are just weren't the response to a question are just so cogent altogether that I don't want to toss anything out there that's just, you know, just rubbish. But... Do you think that we can expect any help from off-planet should things get really stupid down here?
Yes, is the answer.
Oh, good. Oof.
The answer is yes. The problem is that the help has been forthcoming, but people don't see it or understand it. There have been 3 attempts in the last 7 years to detonate a nuclear bomb to create a third world war, and in each time it's been thwarted. There have been countless attempts by elements within Israel, but I always make a difference. I'm Jewish myself, and I make a big difference between being Jewish and being an element of the Zionist regime. But the element of the Zionist regime plays a critical role in many things that take place over this planet. And people need to understand that help has been given on many, many occasions and will be again. But you're asking me, obvious and full-blooded, so that people can know it. Yes, that will happen, but it will happen when there is no other alternative. In other words, when there's no covert way to sort something out, then there will be a physical thing. You see, the governments of the world, and I mean America, because America speaks for the world, that's a fact, as far as the aliens are concerned, and I've made that clear, have given them deadlines in which they request that they tell the people the truth. And each time, the deadline has been pushed back because the American government has come up with some very good arguments. That has run out now. They have a deadline in which they can go public, and the advantage of that is they can control the way that information is disseminated. If they don't do it, it'll be taken out of their hands, and then off-world entities will actually break the news themselves, in which case the government loses control of people and the manipulation of that information. So that's why we have this panic, or partly this panic going on, because they are facing a brick wall. That's it. That's the end of the line. There's nowhere else to go. And you'd think that anybody with any ounce of intelligence would then say, right, let's get round the table and have a talk about this. Let's have a debate. But there is an animal called an ostrich, and, you know, it just stick its head in the ground, and that's exactly what the ruling group are doing at the moment. So come on, ostrich, stick your head out of the ground, come and sit down and have a chat.
Would you mind giving us, before we leave that whole Israeli thing, could you give us a good sound definition of a Zionist?
Somebody who passionately believes that they and their will is correct, and that they have a right to live and others don't have a right to share the same space. That they were destined and born to be who they are, and therefore they are genetically better and historically better than anyone else. And they have been cheated, as they see it, cheated of their birthright. Because we shouldn't imagine that the state of Israel is their birthright. So people who are fundamentally driven, but not seen as fundamentalists because they work within the Western system, they work within the banking system and the political system, they don't dress in turbans and dirty old rags and run around on the back of cheap pickups with machine guns.
Right.
So they are not seen as fanatical because they dress in suits. But their fanaticism is just as strong as anything that the Western media would like to portray. And they have a part to play, just like on a battery you put into a flashlight, it has a positive and a negative. And so they are an element of that battery.
Now there's a rumor that the United Nations has already effectively, now this may be an area you don't want to go into, and if you don't, I'm completely okay with that. But they're already thinking that, that a Palestinian state is going to happen, and in fact pretty much has been formed. Do you have any information to that effect? Do you think that will happen, and is this going to be the trigger point for some new conflagration over there?
Yes, I will go there. This is one view that Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the the leader of Israel, will not tolerate. He will not tolerate a Palestinian state. But President Obama has actually privately and publicly said that this is what he wants to see happen. This could trigger a international situation, which may be what is the underlying plan here. It plays very nicely into Israel's hands because Israel would say that they were acting as they did in 1967 to make a preemptive strike. I went public some time ago that said that there was a hit squad that tried to assassinate Obama some 6 weeks ago, and also the Russian president. And this was coming from the groups we've just been talking about. Because the situation is that Obama is swinging away from the control that has been levered on him. You see, Obama actually always was a decent person. From a very young age, he was born and bred to be the president. He had no choice in the matter. And I see him as a victim. I actually do. I don't see him as an evil man. I see him as a decent person who, before he knew it, was already sucked into it, groomed, planned, programmed, and ready to go. And for a certain time, he ran it because, hey, it was really exciting to be the president. And then you suddenly realize what's going on. And you can either do two things, can't you? You can either do what JFK did and get yourself murdered, or you can attempt to try and ride the waves, try and go with the flow, but not be too bad. And that's what Obama's trying to do. So I don't subscribe to the view that Obama is the devil. He's actually a decent person who's been got at. So we have a situation, I think, where things are polarizing, and different leaders of different countries are having to decide which camp are they in. I mean, for heaven's sake, Great Britain, which was always the most staunchest ally with Australia to America, has actually asked to leave the dollar and to join the new currency that the Russians and the Chinese are setting up. The International Monetary Fund, which is run by the Americans, the head of that, which is a woman, has actually made public statements that she will work with any new currency. People are leaving the ship. The ship is sinking. And who are you going to get left? The people who have got so much blood on their hands that they cannot be forgiven. This is the problem. Because if you have done something that's so heinous and you fear that no one will forgive you, then you never put your hands up and say, I'm sorry. But this is what needs to happen. And exopolitics actually seems to have died a death now, which is a great shame. But one of the key links of exopolitics was that people needed to be forgiven. Well, it's very difficult because if you are the family of somebody who's died and you find out how it was done, you're unlikely to forgive them. But I certainly think that many people have been blackmailed into doing the stuff they've done, have been tricked. So I do think that an opportunity needs to be gone out there to try to bring people back into the fold. It's a very difficult situation, but there are going to be some people who are beyond help, and there will be some form of judgment. There's going to be.
That's pretty strong stuff. That's a lot to think about. It's enough to make you change your mind about a few things. But maybe that's what's called for. Let me ask you this. You've assisted a growing number of Illuminati-related people, whether they're part of the family, that have gone through various traumas and so forth. So it's clear now that for a long time, it seemed like the Illuminati was a thing of legend and myth. But it's a real thing, and they do real things. And those things that they do have some real effects. Now, what do you suppose that noise is?
That's a motorbike.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. I thought it was an alien craft landing in your garden.
They don't make noises like that.
Okay, good. Wouldn't want to wake up to that one. What's that? I don't know, but it's a big disc in the backyard. So what is
it? It'll probably be a false flag, but this is the wrong house to try a false flag on, isn't it?
Absolutely. A dozen better choices in the neighborhood, I'm sure.
Well, they've obviously got their sat-nav went wrong, didn't they? That's what happens when you have things that are human built. The Illuminati, there are two strands to the Illuminati. There's the new bloodline and the old bloodline. The new bloodline goes back to the Italian era, 15th century, 16th century, and they're the new kids on the block. The original Illuminati go back many thousands of years, and they don't always see eye to eye because they have different values. It's like what we call in Britain the new money and the old money, the old landed gentry who had the money and are on the way out, and the new guys who make their money through industry. I hear your question, although maybe the audience didn't understand it, and I'll try and answer it best as I can. The Illuminati wish to control people who work for them. And one of the ways they do that is to do things to their mind. And they'll do it when they're children. And frankly, I don't care who somebody is, what they are, if they were tortured as a child, then there's no rule that says that was right. So when a person comes to me who has suffered trauma as a child, I will put them right, if I can. And I don't judge who, what, where, or when, because they are now a product of what was done to them. Because before that trauma, they're probably just an ordinary round-the-block kid. Okay, they will have come from a very high-end family, but they would have had the same values as you and I. So something was done to them to change them and to control them and make them the person they are now. The person they are now, 9 times out of 10, is not the person that they choose to be. So I will never turn somebody away who comes to me for healing because they never chose to be hurt. So, yes, I will help people. Now, and in the case that I said with the Rothschilds, if I'd known the Rothschilds had sent this person to me, I would have charged a fortune because those people can pay and they can pay plenty. And what I'd do then is I'd use the money partly to offset for people who couldn't afford to pay. This is a good time to mention my website, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
Thank you. I offer a number of range of services, and one of them is what I call deprogramming. So if anybody has that sort of mind control issues, and if they just go to simonparks.org, they can book a session with me. I'm probably the cheapest person around financially for doing it. And if they cannot afford it, and they genuinely can't afford it, then I have received donations from very wealthy people to pay for those people who can't afford it. So I offer a service for free to those people who have serious issues and can't afford to pay it. Others will do that. So, yes, I will help people unless somebody comes to me and says, I willingly allowed them to do this. And I think, well, you know, you're just a fool, and I won't work with someone who doesn't want to get better. But everyone I've met, bar three people genuinely want to get better. So the control system on this planet is horrendous, and even people who research the subject would be totally shocked at the depth and breadth that this system is like a spider's web that goes out. So yeah, that's part of what I do as well.
A growing number of people have come forward. What's a MELAB or MILAB situation? What is that?
This is a term used by researchers when interviewing people and they found a common thread coming through. It stands for military and laboratory. It's when somebody is taken predominantly by military, human military, but sometimes working with the greys or sometimes working with another entity form, but not always, not exclusively so. It can just be military human, both in Britain, America, Canada and Australia. It's very prevalent, and samples are taken from these people. It's the person is considered a very interesting subject. I won't go into a huge amount of detail, but I'm working with a lot of these people now who are brave enough to contact me. And so yes, it's a growing phenomenon.
You know, the word demonic is in this paragraph on your site. The jinn / demonic or stroke demonic possession, and deactivate any suicide programs placed in the person. Suicide programs placed in persons.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can we elaborate a little on that without compromising anything that you may do for somebody?
Of course. Let us just imagine, let your listeners, audience, imagine that we had a secret society, and we'll call it the Cookie Club, because then we don't get too heavy and too upset about it. We have the Cookie Club, and I have 10 people. Well, actually, we should have the number 12, because 12 is very important to us. So we have 12 people who work in the Cookie Club, and I don't want anybody stealing my cookies. So what I do is I take them, and I electrocute them, or I do this and that, or maybe I call up some black magic, and I place something into them. Whatever it is, I want a method to control them so that I don't lose my cookies. The suicide program is a hypnotic program. I'm using the word hypnotic because that's just a very gentle word to use. It's a hypnotic program that ensures, generally, that when a person breaks free of their conditioning, and before they can start to name names or put faces to names, they usually commit suicide. And it's very prevalent in the music industry. It happens a lot. There was a very guy called Forrestal, who was a guy in the 40s who was an American, I can't remember, his defense secretary, but allegedly he jumped from a hospital window.
Yeah, Admiral Forrestal.
That's the guy. He jumped from a window. Jumping from windows is very common for people with these programs. And I have worked with people from, the oldest person I worked with was 60 years of old age, and the youngest I worked with was 16. And it is fascinating to me, from a professional standpoint, to see how mind control has changed. So the 60-year-old, of course, I'm looking at a mind program done 50-odd years ago. So in that particular person's case, it was the Yellow Brick Road programming. Very basic, very straightforward. When I'm working with a 16-year-old, I am working with very modern and learnt methods, which contain subroutines to trap people like me. So in other words, by the time this 16-year-old was being programmed, they were aware of people like me who would go in and deprogram, so they would put booby traps to try and catch me. So it becomes a game between, I don't use the word lightly, of cat and mouse, one side trying to outthink the other. That's the heavy end of it, but I do a really happy end of it, which is what I call a soul reading. A person sits in front of me for 30 minutes on Skype, and I will talk to them about their soul or their higher self, and that's usually very positive and very supportive. So I don't want the listeners to think it's all difficult and my life is just a drudgery. It's not. I have some very happy moments and some very serious moments, and that's how I try to balance my life up.
You know, they say that this thing with some people say that this this suicide until James Forrestal had his meeting with Truman right after the Roswell incident, he didn't have any mental instability at all. And then all of a sudden he did. So it does make one wonder. I suppose that's just the nature of things down here on planet Earth, isn't it? Just what is it? It's just monotony to some degree, punctuated by moments of tragedy, and then somehow the exaltation of the human spirit sort of keeps us going.
Exactly right. People don't realize how wonderful they are. The human spirit is absolutely wonderful. Humans can create reality out of thought. And you know, what other creature anywhere in the multiverse can stand and look at a rainbow or a sunset and say, that's beautiful? You know, we have so much to be happy for and thankful for. Life is so precious on this planet. And anyone who's been to my conferences knows that I always say at some point, why does a nurse get paid less money than a bank manager? Why do you, the human race, and I'm talking of all of us, accept the fact that money is more important than life? And that's what's going to change. That's fundamental. So, you know, let's enjoy the life. Let's connect with what is peaceful and truthful and honest and loving. And let's just push away that which is evil and has no place in our lives. So I'm hoping that humanity will begin to make judgments for itself, not what the local radio station or the local TV station or the newspaper or what comes out of Capitol Hill. Let's try and get people to start thinking for themselves. And listening to your radio show and other shows like yours is fundamental, because they are getting the truth and they are getting stuff that makes them go and do their own research. And that's all I ask of people is, you hear stuff you like, go and do your own research and empower yourself. So, you know, that's why I said I would come on your show, because it's a serious show. You're good quality people and you're there to get the truth out. And that's what it's about. That's what we're driven by, to get the truth out.
Well, you honor us with such a comment. We can only hope to live up to what you just said.
You do.
Well, thank you for that. You know, I've said this a couple of times, and sometimes I wonder if I believe it. Something very deep within me, like an onion, you know, you got to peel away a few layers to actually get to it. It's like, yep, it's there. I still somehow, I have always been sort of to paraphrase Michael in that old movie Heat. For me, the action is the juice, is what he said. Of course, he was a criminal. And didn't make it to the end of the movie, by the way. His character didn't. But the thing is I've said, look, it is possible to have peace. But it doesn't have to be the boring lie about peace. It can be an exciting peace. It can be an invigorating peace. It can be an inspirational peace that drives us to more discovery and taking risks, but responsible risks that don't risk, you know, entire segments of humanity in furtherance of some momentary glorification. And I'm just wondering, can you reinforce that? Is it possible to have an exciting peace so that we're not compelled to just start some trouble with somebody because we're just too bored with this lovely peace that we're doing? What do we have to change about ourselves to get to that
right,
mindset?
It's just pure manipulation from those who wish to gain more. Most countries have developed to a certain size and then found the limit at which they can operate at. But when you are a country like America that is 22 times in debt over the value of your own country, that's the scale of it, 22 times more than the country's worth, the only way you can maintain any forward momentum is to absorb other countries, the wealth of other countries, and that's what invasions are about. That's why it was very keen to start on Iran. It didn't happen for some very interesting reasons. But it isn't the people that want the war. The people are manipulated into thinking that this is payback time for the bad guys. The reality is it's all about making money and resources. Because at the moment there are two resources which are scant on this planet. One is food and one is energy. And if you can have control of food and energy, then you have control of the planet. Not so much water. People always think water. There's actually more water than we think. It's food and energy that are the two key things. So as long as you want to grow your country over and above anything that's reasonable, you have to absorb other countries. You have to take them over. And that's what wars are, generally.
You know, and it seems to me that that's very interesting. And by allowing 25% of the entire population of Mexico into our country, we have by, shall I say, default, actually absorbed their country, haven't we?
Yes.
I never thought of that until this moment.
Well, there are many ways of absorbing a country. You can actually say to another country, do you know what? We've got so many of your people here, you should start paying us, because our social security check is so big now. And if you don't pay us, we'll push all these people back into your country and it will bankrupt you.
Oh, Simon, this is extraordinary. I never thought, look.
You wouldn't.
I don't consider myself to be a brilliant man, but I don't consider myself to be a moron either.
No, you're not stupid at all. But I couldn't come into your studio and do what you do, because you're an expert in your field and you're absolutely brilliant at what you do. I couldn't do that. But somebody couldn't come into my field because they haven't had the background and the knowledge. And so what we do is we say, I'm good at this, you're good at that, let's put it together and be a team. And so the information I give you, you put out. And that's how we work as a team. So the other thing is that I wanted to say was that I listen to a lot of people on radio shows. And for me, this is precious time. This is precious time. I want to make every minute count. When I'm talking to people, I need to get the truth and the message out there. So I don't want to tell you what I had for breakfast. I don't want to tell you what film I watched or Aunt Lucy did this or did that. I need to tell you the facts. So when I get asked questions, I respond in a very blunt way. And I don't do the niceties, because I've only got an hour or 2 hours, and that is human race time. That's what I call it off the record. I call it the human race's time, my time to connect with the good people of this planet. So sometimes I can be too much for people because I don't breathe. I did a Skype with a lovely theater in California. I did a live Skype, and I did 5 hours. I did 2.5 hours nonstop, 15 minutes break, and another 2.5 hours. That audience were fantastic. They sat there for 5 hours to listen to me. And when the energies are going and you really go for it, then you can achieve a great deal. And so my mission is to help people one way or another. And your mission is to get the truth out directly through an electronic means. So I will know stuff that most people don't know. That's not big-headed. I don't go on the internet. I don't pay people to go on the internet to pass me information. I have people who come to me and say, this is going down. Are you interested? I have off-world contacts. And I only go public when the off-world contact information matches that from on-world. So I have two independent sources. And when those two independent sources match, I'm then confident to go forward. But if I get something from one angle or not another, I just hang on to that and wait and see if it's going to be covered up. There are very few people in this position, and I appreciate that, but it's not too big for me. I saw a very famous American UFO guy who I've got a lot of time for, and I'll just give a clue away that he was one of the first guys to talk about global warming wasn't true. It was heating up of the planets. And he's absolutely right. But he was on a television interview and he burst into tears because he'd had a death threat. Now, I'm not making a judgment on that on itself, but what I would say is every bad guy in the world now knows that that guy has a weak point, that he can be twisted and squeezed. You cannot afford to show weakness when you are at this level, because the people that you're playing against have no fear and have no weakness. So you either are in the game or you're not. And this is a game that I intend to win for the human race, because the people are worth it. They are worth it. For all the nastiness and the sadness that the news puts out, actually people are good. Fundamentally, people are good. And I think we just need to take the control programs away and let people actually rediscover who they are. So, you know, fingers crossed for the future, eh?
Yes. So much for asking you what you would like to leave the good people of the earth with. That was beautiful, Simon, it really was. And I must say that in the manner of his lordship, Patrick McGoohan, the late Patrick McGoohan, you have gloriously illustrated and vindicated the right of the individual to be individual, and I hereby induct you into the Order of the Ark Knights, and this assembly rises to you, Sir Simon.
Thank you very much indeed. But you also have to give me 100 sovereigns and say that's your pocket money and traveler's checks to 1,000,000.
Don't worry about it. I've got it right here in the bag. That's why they call me the Bag Man. Bagman of the stars, and we don't mean Hollywood stars, do we? Listen, this has been just a fantastic conversation. This is really just so deliciously complicated, and yet at the same time so completely clear. Sorry, had to borrow from Holmes just for a moment. Do you have any events planned that involved your being in the United States anytime soon?
You're going to smile. I cannot fly.
Oh.
I cannot fly.
Boat?
To America. That's why I did an Exus conference. I did it by Skype to Australia. That went down really well. They ran 2 screens, one for me, so the audience could see me, and a separate screen where I could put my drawings and my slides up. And then I did the conference to the theater in California. So I'm very happy to do Skype presentations. And the reason I won't fly, and I'll just tell you, I think it's interesting, it's amusing. When you see an aeroplane, you see an aeroplane. When I see an aeroplane, I see something made of very thin metal with stress, full of thousands of gallons of explosive fuel, and only humans to fly it.
Right. Well, yeah. So you've just talked yourself out of it, yeah?
And no supercomputer to take control of it. Now, that is not to denigrate the pilot. The pilots are a gift, because I've just said to you, I couldn't come in and do your job. And the pilots are brilliant. And I should be strong enough to know that those that look after me are not going to let me die in an aeroplane crash. But the problem is that when you have been on alien spacecraft, and I have, and you've seen how they work, and then you look at human technology and you think, I'm not getting in that. So that is the reason why I can't fly. And it's terrible, because the people of America broadly have accepted me and have listened to me, and my heart goes out to them, because the American people are perhaps some of the finest people on the planet. I'll say that again. The American people are some of the finest people on the planet. And I would dearly love to be able to shake them by the hand, physically be with them, support them, and give them words of encouragement. I can't do it physically, but if any exposium or conference wants to book me to do a half an hour or an hour presentation by Skype, I will do it. So there's the offer.
Well, that sounds great. It also, I'm thinking there may be a trip. Airplane, after what he said, yeah, I'll chance it. I'll chance it.
You are very welcome to come and visit me, and next time you are in the UK, you have to let me know, and we will meet, and we will spend some time together. Because although you haven't asked for a soul reading, I will tell you that you are higher human, so your soul is not of an Earth human type, it's of a higher human type. I won't go into the stuff other than that, because it's too private, and that would be between me and my client. But you and I are connected. You and I do know each other on some level. That's a fact.
I feel certain that's true.
And also, I would just say to you that something happened to you in your childhood, which we won't discuss now.
Oh, yes. Not what you might think. It's something very unusual.
No. Yeah. Yes, it did. But we won't discuss that now.
It is written. We will meet in person sooner. I'm hoping before the end of the year.
It would be lovely. It would be lovely. Often when I play cards or what have you with my children, my children say, Dad, will you turn it off? Because I use my psychic ability to cheat sometimes when playing cards. So you better not play cards with me.
Okay. No. The only one I'll chance it with, the only game I'll take a chance with would be blackjack.
Oh, well, I like that.
Oh, me too. That's the only one I really have a chance at.
I think we're drawing the show to a conclusion, and I know you're the host and you have to draw it to a conclusion, but I just want to say how lovely it's been to be with you and your sound guy, who I can't see there. But thank you very much for inviting me, and I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope actually, it's been positive, and it's going to have some positive effect for your audience.
I feel, that's written too. Thank you very much, Simon Parkes. Very much. Simon Parkes, PARKES.org. Go and see him. Visit his website. And, you know, I'm not about to change our little saying of make ready for what's to come for, what would it be? Make ready for what's already happening. We can't really do that because, well, we don't stand still in time, do we? So, it'll be a traditional goodbye and fare thee well on this episode of Caravan to Midnight. Thank you very much for being with us. It is an honor to be with you. And exercise caution in your daily affairs. Keep your eyes up, always. Sharpen those critical thinking skills. And make ready for what's to come. Be seeing you.